Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Here's a story coming up tomorrow on Weekend Edition. Last December, many parts of the country were still struggling to cope with a surge of COVID cases. And that meant many churchgoers stayed home, missing out on traditional Christmas celebrations like candlelight services. So this summer, some congregations are taking advantage of relaxed pandemic restrictions to celebrate Christmas in July.
It feels like we've come out as a community, as a church, as a nation. We're on our way out of a long winter.
Tune in tomorrow. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name. And finally today, a young star is spelling her way into the history books.
The word is Maria.
Maria. Does this word contain, like, the English name Murray, which could be the name of a comedian, or just the English name in general?
I don't see that here.
Bill Murray made the spelling bee.
Maria. M-U-R-R-A-Y-A.
That is correct!
That is 14-year-old Zaila Avant-Garde, winning the 2021 Scripps National Spelling Bee. So let us add our congratulations to those already extended by Halle Berry, former President and First Lady Barack and Michelle Obama, and, of course, Bill Murray. But you might have heard this isn't her only accomplishment, just the latest. She already has 3 records in the Guinness Book of World Records for her basketball dribbling skills. We wanted to catch up with Zaila Avant-Garde to talk about her success, and she is with us now. Zaila Avant-Garde, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So it's been just over a week since your win. What's the coolest thing to come from this experience so far?
One of the coolest things that happened was, like, just traveling around and stuff. I really like going on trips and stuff, and, like, being in the airplanes. Like, the airplanes sometimes had TVs in them, so that was pretty cool. And also, when I went to the ESPYs, I got to talk to Sha'Carri Richardson, which is super cool to me. There's so many other cool things, but that's just a brief, some of them.
Oh, yeah, just the ESPYs, sure. That sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good. I know that. And also, you were on the Jimmy Kimmel, and your guy, of course, Bill Murray, as I saw, he was cheering you on. So, you know, you've only been competing in spelling for 2 years. What got you started?
Basically, since I was a young child, reading in words has, like, always been something that I loved. Reading books, I've read, like, over 1,000 books. So that's definitely something I've done a lot of. And then my father saw the spelling bee and stuff and asked me some words from them. I was surprised at the fact that I could spell some of them. And it kind of became an idea there, just kind of, I wonder if you should put her into a spelling bee. And then I asked for my 12th birthday for, like, entrance into my local regionals, and I won my regionals and went to Scripps for the first time.
So you kind of got your appetite whetted there.
Yeah.
Would it be accurate to say you're kind of competitive anyway? I mean, before, as we mentioned, you became Spelling Bee champion, you already had 3 Guinness World Records for most balls juggled in 1 minute, most dribbles in 30 seconds, and most balls dribbled simultaneously by one person, which is 6. How did you all come up with, how did that happen?
The way that happened basically was that, like, when I was 8 years old, I got the Guinness World Record book for my 8th birthday. When I saw it, I, like, wanted to be in that book. And then for my 13th birthday, I asked to try to work towards a Guinness World Record kind of as a celebration of becoming a teenager.
Oh, that's exciting. But of all of your accomplishments so far, which one was the hardest to attain and which one means the most?
I don't know. I always struggle with answering this question. Sometimes I feel like spelling is the hardest, and then sometimes I feel like basketball is the hardest thing I've done.
I hear what you're saying.
I think spelling probably because of just the mental acuity that it takes.
Spell that for me. Acuity. Hmm? Spell acuity for me.
Oh, acuity. A-C-U-I-T-Y.
Okay, thank you. I knew it. You knew I was going to do that at some point, so thank you for indulging me. Now, I've read several interviews with you, and I know that you know you're only the second Black girl to win the contest and the first African American. What does that mean to you? And I realize that's a big question, and it's something that you may or may not have thought about. You're not required to think about stuff like that, so I hope you understand that that's entirely your choice. But I wondered, what does that mean to you at this point?
I'm definitely hoping that some girls of African American and Hispanic too, girls will look at me and maybe think about this, because it's a really fun thing to do and it's really great for the mind and just learning how to learn and also learning how to study for school and stuff. So I'm definitely hoping that people look at me and kind of get interested in this type of thing.
What's the best thing about spelling? Tell me a little bit more about why competitive spelling is a fun thing to do.
The idea of fun is kind of subjective. I sometimes would bore my parents with my excited talks about, and I found this new root and it's going to connect perfectly with this word or something like that, which is super boring to most people, or maybe a lot. Oh, who knows? I don't quite know what's boring to whom. But the thing that's super exciting to me about spelling is learning language patterns or just rules and also roots. I just love learning about languages, and it's also kind of a good segue, I should say, into learning about different cultures, which is something I'm super interested in.
What are you thinking about when you, for future career, for example?
My main things that I'm interested in is something working with NASA, or maybe being an NBA basketball coach is something I'm really interested in. I also have some side interest in neuroscience, treating diseases and stuff, but kind of understanding, for those that have them, the sort of the sources of the problems. And also, I have some interest, since I saw the two women who won a Nobel Prize in a connection with CRISPR, I have some interest in gene editing.
Something tells me that you're not going to have any difficulty pursuing any of those. Well, congratulations. Lots of people rooting for you, cheering you on, and I hope that this experience is everything that you dreamed of. That was Zaila Avant-Garde, 2021 Scripps National Spelling Bee champion, and as we said, Guinness World Record holder in a number of basketball skills. Zaila Avant-Garde, thank you so much for talking to us. I hope we'll talk again.
Thank you. I hope to talk to you soon, too.
Turn the TV on.
Aw, come on, Dad. We watching us.
I got some news about your mother. I want everybody to listen to me real good. The doctors told me that your mother's sicker than we thought.
What?
They found cancer.
What cancer?
Many of us should be testing regularly for various forms of cancer: colorectal, breast, prostate, cervical. That's what the CDC recommends. But during the pandemic, these kinds of screenings plummeted, and now doctors say they're diagnosing later stage cancers that could have been caught earlier. And they say many patients haven't yet resumed getting their checkups. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has been looking into this. Hi, Yuki.
Hi, Noel.
So the stakes here are pretty high for people's health. How much did the pandemic affect screening for cancer?
Yeah, so early on in April of last year, the CDC says cancer screenings declined nearly 90%. Even today, things remain far off normal. And, screening can detect cancers early when treatment is easier and more effective. But, of course, for many people last year, the fear of COVID overshadowed fears of cancer.
Is this changing as more people get vaccinated?
Yeah, it's starting to. But given the big backlog, doctors say they should be seeing many more patients. Another huge concern is that people who live in rural areas, Latino, Black, and other patients of color, are all more likely to have missed, postponed, or canceled screenings. And once again, these are communities where accessing healthcare is, and really always has been, challenging in so many ways.
How big a deal is it to miss or delay an appointment?
You know, if it's only a few months and you're at low risk, it's not likely that dangerous. But delays tend to ripple out, throwing people off schedule. And modeling data from the National Cancer Institute shows that last year's drop in testing for breast and colorectal cancers alone will lead to 10,000 additional deaths over the next decade. It's like a hidden toll of the pandemic. And the problem is, you know, once you skip a pap smear, say, then you might not get the reminder to schedule your next exam. Or maybe you moved or lost a job and don't have a primary care doctor, you know, keeping tabs on you. So in short, many people don't know which screenings they should be getting. And that's what worries doctors like David Cohn, who's chief medical officer at the James Cancer Center at Ohio State University. A skipped appointment, he says, too easily stretches into years, and that's risky.
That's when we're going to start to see a dramatic rise in either the number of cancers that are diagnosed or those that are diagnosed are going to be diagnosed later.
I spoke with a woman exactly in that situation. Her name is Pam Nelson. She raised four boys on a sprawling converted campground on the western edge of Pennsylvania, where bears trudge through and chickens roam.
It's farm country, and the kids drive their tractors to school on prom day.
Normally, Nelson drives an hour and a half in a car, not her tractor, to get mammograms every year.
About 12 years ago, I had breast cancer found by mammogram. Thank goodness.
But last year, the pandemic delayed her appointment until October. That revealed a mass the size of a penny. Further evaluation took longer also because of the worsening pandemic.
It was December before I could get biopsies, because everything's all jammed up, so you had to wait an entire month.
Nelson couldn't schedule her lumpectomy until late January. Had it not been for the pandemic, she says,
I think it would have been found at a smaller stage.
So, Noelle, imagine that kind of scenario playing out for many people.
Yeah, I can see the extent of the problem in that one story. And then you said, Yuki, that these kinds of delays are affecting people of color disproportionately. Why is that?
Yes, the Prevent Cancer Foundation just released a survey this month showing Latino patients are 30% more likely to have missed or postponed screenings than white patients, and Black patients are 19% more likely to have missed their screenings. Jody Hoyos is the president of the foundation. She says this.
But I think it's just an exacerbation of the same barriers we see all the time.
You know, barriers like lack of insurance or shortage of doctors, especially in remote areas, but also busy work schedules can get in the way, or not having a car.
What can doctors and hospitals do about this if there's nothing that patients can do about it?
Well, you know, structural issues of insurance are hard to address. But on the practical side, some cancer centers are trying to offer free transportation or paying for parking. I talked to Karen Knudsen, who's the CEO of the American Cancer Society. Before that, though, she was director of oncology at a cancer center in Philadelphia. And she says centers around the country are trying to bridge those gaps in care.
When we started opening mammography on the weekends, we found that it was one of the most popular times to get your mammogram.
The center where she worked also now sends mobile medical units into neighborhoods where screening rates are low.
And when we talk about inequality in access to healthcare, you and others at NPR have done reporting on this. We are not just talking about logistics. There are some cultural divides or differences here.
Yeah, that's right. There's a deep skepticism about medicine in parts of these communities. And I've talked to patients, even a doctor, who say they felt ignored, dismissed, even shamed about their bodies by physicians. And they felt it was because of their race. And that's a deterrent, you know. Kavita Jackson is 33, an Indian American. Her breast cancer diagnosis came right as the pandemic began. She's a doctor, so she can advocate for her own care, but she's seen others struggle.
I've seen many other women been completely turned away. Oh, you're only 30. Oh, no, this doesn't affect you. People getting turned away are not being taken seriously.
Jodi Ann Bury says that's why she started a podcast called Black Cancer during the pandemic. For 2 years, she said, doctors dismissed her cancer symptoms. The podcast, she says, is her way of advising others to persist through those roadblocks.
Trusting yourself, screenings, genetic testing. I think we need as much information as possible, particularly people of color.
She says patients really need to take control, educate themselves about which screenings they need, and then advocate for their own care, because otherwise they risk falling through the cracks.
Yeah, that sounds like good advice. NPR health correspondent Yuki Noguchi. Yuki, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you, Noelle.
Yo, we stripped the teeth to fill his pipe and wander around to find on. Hold it now, wait. Yo, run the block. Succotash is a meal for kids that make cash, selling drugs to the brother man instead of the other man.
Brother than sister.
I'm talking about
more than 93,000 people in the United States died from drug overdoses last year. That is according to provisional data released by the National Center for Health Statistics. It is a huge spike in deaths from overdoses. And we know the pandemic increased isolation, stress, and economic anxiety, all of which are factors associated with increased drug use. NPR's health correspondent Ritu Chatterjee is here to tell us more about these numbers. Hey, Ritu.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So more than 93,000 deaths. It's so big. It's so awful. Give us some context for that number.
So, yeah, it's nearly a 30% jump compared to 2019. And I spoke with Dr. Nora Volkov. She's the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And she says this was the largest rise in overdose deaths in a 12-month period that we've ever seen. And the peak in those overdose deaths, she says, was for people between the ages of 35 and 45. So we're talking about people in their most productive years with a lot of responsibilities.
The magnitude of the cost to our society of lives lost from overdoses is gigantic.
And she says that the pandemic really exacerbated the opioid crisis, which, as we know, has been going on now for years.
Yeah. So is one piece of this more people were using drugs during the pandemic?
Exactly. That's one reason, because the pandemic raised the risks for drug use. Here's Dr. Volkov again.
We were aware that the stress and the social distancing and the uncertainties from the pandemic were going to actually lead to increased drug consumption. And we have seen this in the country.
And she also said that public health officials were so focused on dealing with a pandemic that it took attention and resources away from the addiction crisis. And I also spoke with Chuck Ingolia. He's the president and CEO of National Council for Mental Wellbeing. And he said that a lot of in-person supports and services went away or were cut back significantly.
Many of the frontline services, street outreach, harm reduction, were also curtailed during the pandemic.
And this really affected people who were on the path to recovery, right? And it made it more likely that they would relapse. And when you add to that the rise in availability of synthetic opioids like fentanyl, it's easy to see why there was such a huge spike in overdose deaths.
Now, I'm curious, because we know that the pandemic hit Black communities, hit brown communities harder. Do the new data show similar disparities in overdose deaths?
So the new data don't parse things out by race and ethnicity. However, there was a study earlier this year that found that in Philadelphia, the surge in drug overdose deaths last year was higher for Black residents. And there are similar findings in California. But one thing that the new data does provide is a state-by-state breakdown. So, for example, Kentucky, Vermont, South Carolina saw more than a 50% rise in overdose deaths. And I have to mention Florida and California just from the because of the sheer numbers. California lost more than 9,000 lives to overdoses, and Florida more than 7,000.
And is there a plan to try to turn this around, bring the numbers down this year?
I asked Ingolia the same thing, and he said he's hopeful because there is increased funding to address this.
The Biden-Harris administration is really prioritizing the full continuum of interventions, everything from harm reduction to, you know, increased treatment capacity.
But he said we really need long-term funding to tackle this.
To tackle it for good, sure. That is NPR's Ritu Chatterjee. Thank you.
Thank you.
So listen, y'all, can we talk? I mean, like, really talk? Now, the answer to that question depends on whether we share the same language. And these days, it can be hard to feel that we do. For example, bruh, you're killing it, could be the highest praise or a troubling trigger.
Wait, did you say trigger?
Yes, like the triggers that victims of violence experience.
Victims? Don't you mean survivors?
Yeah, okay, survivors. But listen, killing it is just something a lot of people of color say.
Wait, people of what?
See what I mean? So again, can we talk? I'm joined now by John McWhorter, a contributing writer at The Atlantic, who also teaches linguistics at Columbia University, hosts the podcast Lexicon Valley, and is the author of 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Always. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so thrilled to talk with you. So you recently authored a piece in The Atlantic, and it was about this oppressive language list published by the Prevention, Advocacy, and Resource Center at Brandeis. And to be clear, it wasn't an institutional rule or mandate, but you did see it as kind of a sign of the times. Talk to me about that.
Well, you know, we're in a time when we're often told that policing language is part of making the world better. The policing language is part of a concerned progressive agenda. And that sort of thing is argued so passionately that it's easy to forget that it's really just a proposition. And so, of course, language can nudge thought along to an extent. It makes perfect sense to me that we might call all people who are heroic heroes instead of having a word like heroine, or calling all people who act actors instead of, you know, having the idea that an actress is something different. But there comes a point when somebody who has a hammer sees everything as a nail, and we're at a point where we're told that we have to watch what seems like every third thing we say. That opening audio montage really expressed it better than I can. And I really think that we need to do a thought experiment. Think about a real progressive who had ideals that I think most of us would agree with. Think about Emma Goldman, and think about the things that she was doing. I imagine presenting to Emma Goldman something like that list of terms that you're not supposed to use from Brandeis, or in general, taking Emma Goldman into our times and showing her the way we urge one another to police our language, she would think it was utterly ridiculous. She would say, you know, honey, forget it. We're supposed to be out in the world doing real things, helping people who need help. This business of policing the way people express themselves and hearing obscure resonances in terms and pretending to be hurt by things has nothing to do with putting food in anybody's mouth. And I think, frankly, she wasn't from another time and primitive and unenlightened. I think she was right. We're taking things a little bit too seriously these days.
And so could it be a bit of a both and? So what I love whenever I talk with you or listen to you talk about language is your sense that language is living, right? That that words do go out of favor because we have collectively decided that we're not going to use them, apparently adverbs now, but that they also come into being, right? That it, for me, it's part of the joy and creativity of Black folk has to do with the ways that we have shaped and molded multiple languages, but certainly the English language, and created new words. So might it be that, in fact, some words would get policed out, just not by the rules of institutions?
Yeah, I think that we need to consider that when we change words, often we're just postponing what's going to be the same problem. And so, for example, Negro, that changes to Black. And that was fine. It meant that Negro had accreted certain negative associations in the eyes of many. And so we were going to replace that with a more positive term, Black, and also take Black back from the idea that there's something wrong with something being Black as opposed to white, dirty, as opposed to clean. And then 25 years later, African-American comes in, the idea being that Black has negative associations, African-American expresses who we are better. Now we seem to be in a time when African-American is going out of style. I suppose the idea is that it has negative associations with it, stereotypes, and that we need a new term to encourage a new way of seeing us. And it seems like we're going back to Black, except the idea is that it's with a capital letter. It seems to me that really we need to work on the associations rather than thinking so much about the terminology. And this is not just a Black thing. This is an Anglophone leftist culture issue these days that I think we might need to reconsider.
Sure. I guess, you know, it's interesting as you talk about Negro, Afro-American, African-American, Black. For me as a writer, just, you know, whether it is, you know, times when I'm actually being productive enough to write several thousand words in a week, or whether I'm grading and reading tens of thousands of words, I just always want more words. I want to have as many words as possible to say all the possible things. So I might want to use Negro if I'm talking about a specific time period, and then Afro-American if I'm talking about, you know, folks who are actually engaged in thinking of themselves in those terms. Is there a way that we can introduce, rather than policing, a way to think about how we can use all the words in language, but in ways that are purposefully not meant to harm?
I think, yes, we can do that. We can be more vigilant than, say, Emma Goldman may have been about whether or not words can harm, but not to the point that what we're really doing is playing a little game that you can almost imagine kids playing in the backseat of the car in the 70s and 80s before there was an internet, where you come up with labored ways that words might be hurtful, such as, you know, looking up that rule of thumb may have, although it didn't, come from an idea that a British man was allowed to hurt his wife with something as long as it wasn't as broad as a thumb. Somebody at Brandeis actually looked that up, found that actually, you know, rather silly story, and decided that we should stop saying rule of thumb. That's taking it too far. And when you take these things too far, what happens is, as you're implying, you're stanching creativity. It gets to the point where we can't use the full resources of our language. For example, you know, I too read students' papers. I too write a lot every week. We can't do that because there's almost always a way that you can come up with a way that words are hurtful. And so, for example, the Brandeis document says, don't say crazy, because that is that's not polite to people who have that kind of mental problem for real. Say bananas. But you know what's next? It's going to be that you can't use bananas because it's dismissive, and it also is probably not respectful of people who make their living picking bananas. That's literally something somebody might come up with. There's always something. We're taking it too far. And yes, what it means is that you end up stanching our basic human creativity. And that's especially the fact when people are being artistic, when people are expressing their subculture, when people are just being human. This is an inhuman way of treating the gift of language.
And yet I want to leave room just for the one possibility that there may be words that we individually make a choice not to use, right? So for me, no contribution is ever seminal. It's always ovarian. And I get, John, the ways in which that's kind of silly. I wouldn't ever take it away from other folks. And it's a valuable word. It's just not one that MHP uses. John McWhorter is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. I always appreciate talking with you and about language with you. Thanks for joining us today.
I avoid that word too, because I don't know how to say it. And thank you for having me.
Oh, John.
The man not. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of Black manhood.
Over the past year, many people have taken up activities they can do outdoors, and one that's become popular is geocaching. It's a high-tech treasure hunt using GPS coordinates for hidden containers called caches, and there are more than a million of them across the United States. Sarah Kate Kramer brings us the story of one geocacher who, in his searches, has had to navigate more than just the terrain.
Since he started geocaching 3 years ago, Marcellus Cad has found a cache every day. On his best day, he found 274. Recently, he went hunting for a geocache in Austin, and I asked him to record himself on his phone.
Right now, we're supposed to be about 22 feet away from it.
We're in an open field except for, like, some trees.
That's Cad's 12-year-old daughter, Gemma, who was helping him find a cache in the 90-degree Texas heat. They didn't know exactly what it would look like. The cache might be a film canister, an ammo can. Suddenly, Gemma spotted a little orange container nestled at the bottom of a tree.
Oh, is that it down there?
Oh, yeah, that's totally it.
Cad's 10-year-old daughter, Zoe, opened the cache.
And there's some hand sanitizer in here, a lollipop, yellow star stickers, and the log, of course. Yeah, and the log, of course.
Do you ladies want to sign the log?
Cad likes taking his daughters geocaching, but most of the time, he does it solo. His favorite part is how geocaching is a way to explore the country.
I have seen so many things, and I have been to so many places. Places that I wouldn't have gone on my own. I get to have a little miniature treasure hunt every day.
But soon after he started, Cad realized that he was having a different experience than the majority of geocachers in the U.S., who are white.
I was reading a forum post where somebody asked, how many times have you guys been stopped by cops?
Most geocachers said they were rarely, if ever, bothered by the police.
And I was thinking to myself, man, I've been doing this 6 months and I've been stopped 7 times.
And it's not only the police who question Cad. Strangers, almost always white, often ask why he's poking around their neighborhood. So he's developed some tricks to avoid attention. Here he is looking for a cache in downtown Austin.
I'm carrying a clipboard with me, so, you know, they might think that I'm working here. If you look like you're working, then people don't tend to pay attention to you.
Cad started a blog called Geocaching While Black to document his experiences dealing with racism during his travels. He's been to every county in Texas, and once he ended up in a park dedicated to the memory of the Confederacy. The geocache was hidden in the bottom of the flagpole.
And I'm like, I'm going to have to get this thing out from under the Confederate flag. And I signed it and I put it back so I could get the heck out of there.
But Cad is actually hoping his blog will encourage more people of color to geocache.
There's a certain joy in being black and basically going out into places where you don't see a lot of black people. And being able to say, I am here, whether you like it or not.
Marcellus Cad. His goal is to find a geocache in every county in the United States. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Kate Kramer.
I'm reaching. Bingo.
The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii. And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
For a long time, gene editing has been promised as a way to fix some of our greatest and most challenging health problems. But it also raises ethical questions about how much we should change our DNA, the very building blocks of life. And just as critically, who should get to make those decisions? Now, the World Health Organization is weighing in. On Monday, the agency issued 2 reports recommending new global standards for gene editing. They aim to prevent unscrupulous, inequitable, and potentially dangerous uses of the technology. Joining us to discuss what's in the report and its implications for science and future medical treatments is our health reporter, Amy Doxer-Marcus. Hi, Amy. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Let's start off with some basics. What do we mean when we say gene editing? And the other term I suspect will come up a lot in today's conversation is CRISPR. Can you tell us what that is?
You know, all of us have a genetic code that makes up who we are and determines all kinds of things about everything from the way we look to the kind of health we have. And although we share many things in common in our genetic codes, all of us are unique and different. And we have different genetic variations that make us so special. And some of those variations can be harmful. They can make us more susceptible to getting diseases. And so there has been an effort to use technologies that would enable scientists to take cells from our body or even, you know, do editing inside our body and make changes, make tweaks that could mean changing a DNA to improve something, cutting out DNA, adding DNA. But all these things would try to correct illnesses and be used for our benefit. That was sort of some of the initial idea behind gene editing. And over the years, there have been a number of different approaches to doing this. And CRISPR is a recent one and probably one of the best known ones.
So tell us a little bit about that. How far advanced is this technology? What have scientists been able to do with it so far?
I think one of the reasons why you're seeing more public discussion over these topics is because CRISPR has made some remarkable strides in recent years. For example, we've done reporting on a number of clinical trials that have started to report results, meaning that CRISPR has been used to edit people that have serious conditions, such as sickle cell anemia, which is an inherited blood disorder, cancer, and other disorders, it's one thing to talk about the use of these technologies hypothetically, but to actually put it into people, to experiment on people and to have results that it's improving people's lives or that it's reducing their level of pain or that it's reducing toxic proteins in their body, these sorts of results are starting to come out, and it's making people feel optimistic that this tool really will be able to make a difference in people's health.
Right. So this is very promising technology, but it is raising some serious ethical questions. Tell us why this panel was convened in the first place. What was the catalyst?
Yes. I mean, that's a really important question. The WHO, and by the way, other organizations also around the same time, convened this commission, this advisory committee, in late 2018. And the timing is not a coincidence, because in November 2018, there was a Chinese researcher who announced at a big scientific meeting that he had used CRISPR to edit the DNA of embryos, and that he had implanted those embryos in women, and that twins had been born. And then he also announced that a third woman was pregnant with a child that was also genetically modified. This was quite shocking and stirred up enormous public outcry, because this announcement represented the first known time that genetically modified babies had been born. It also raised a lot of ethical questions, because when you change the genes in an embryo, it's not just going to affect the health and the life of that single individual that results from the embryo, but all these changes will be passed down to future generations. And those future generations aren't going to be able to weigh in and consent to all the changes that were made to the DNA. And instead, it was a scientist making profound decisions that have impact, you know, wider, you know, beyond individual lives, without really having a lot of people weigh in on it. And that was very troubling.
And so you mentioned, you know, one scientist making these decisions by himself, not really having maybe a ton of input from other people, and it impacting generations to come. But that wasn't the only scenario that the WHO was trying to prevent or avoid. What were some of the other scenarios they were concerned about?
One of them that they talked about in the reports was the idea that you might have parents who come in trying to get pregnant, and they want to use gene editing to try to give, you know, greater muscle mass to their child, or, you know, that might lead to greater athletic ability. They also discussed there's a potential that these technologies will be tested in clinical trials in people that live in countries that don't have a lot of resources, low-income countries, that the companies will develop these technologies using the bodies and the contributions of these lower resource countries. And then any of these technologies that emerge will be so expensive that the people who helped develop them, that were part of the clinical trials, they won't be able to afford them. It will only be available to people who live in rich countries. So they were very concerned about that. They were concerned about also people traveling to countries where gene editing perhaps is loosely regulated, and therefore they could get access to this technology to do things that in their own home country would not be permitted, would be considered illegal. They were concerned about that scenario. They tried to imagine sort of all the dark, sort of potentially worst case scenarios that might emerge if there isn't a common set of practices, if there isn't an effort to arrive at an understanding.
Well, so what were some of the recommendations that they came up with, and how would they help with some of these scenarios?
They recommended that there be a registry that all scientists over the world would contribute to, in which they would discuss what some of the early experimental work, while it's still research in the lab, they recommended creating a mechanism for whistleblowers. It would enable a mechanism for them to come forward and to report something unethical is happening, and it needs to be addressed.
And so they've got these recommendations, these guidelines that they've now issued. Are they binding in any way, or is it still up to individual governments to set their own rules?
I mean, that's the problem with all of this. This is not binding. They don't have any mandate to force you to do anything.
But they do set a norm. Countries can pass laws. Scientific journals can establish practices where if scientists don't meet certain norms, they can't publish, you know, their papers. Like, there are ways to enforce things. But the point of these reports that the WHO published was to suggest strategies that then countries or professional organizations or institutions could adopt, but they themselves cannot mandate that their advice be taken.
You know, and on that note, this technology seems to be moving pretty fast. What does it mean for guidelines like this?
I think one of the things it means is that it's pretty hard to keep up guidelines when technology is developing so quickly. And one of the points that the WHO advisory committee made in the reports was, let's revisit this no later than 3 years from now, because it's hard for it to stay ahead of the science. The science is, you know, usually a few laps ahead. And that, I think, is one of the struggles that marks this particular technology from the beginning, is the struggle by scientists not only to understand the science, but to make sure that the public understands the ethical implications, you know, and gets to weigh in before it's too late.
That's our reporter, Amy Doxer-Marcus. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
If you're arrested for a felony in the state of California, the law says you have to give a sample of your DNA. But things in that realm are a little different in Orange County. In OC, minor misdemeanors like walking your dog without a leash can result in you giving up your DNA. That's because of a program started under the OC's former district attorney, Tony Rakakis, and now is continuing under the current DA, Todd Spitzer. It's also being challenged in court. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So apparently this DNA collection program is locally known as Spit and Acquit. Tell us more about it.
It's exactly what it sounds like. Say you commit a misdemeanor, something like walking your dog without a leash, DUI, something like even like an infraction, and you go to court and you're like, okay, I'm just gonna have to pay a fine. It sucks, but whatever. Well, in recent years, ever since 2007, when this program started, prosecutors would go like, say, hey, it's not that simple, but we'll wipe out all the charges if you just give us a sample of your DNA. And most people, they're, you know, they don't want to go to court. They don't want to go through multiple days and all of that stuff. And they'll say, okay, you just need my DNA. I just need a spit and you'll acquit. Sure, I'll do it.
I mean, how big is this DNA database?
182,000 people have taken that, which is bigger than some county DNA or state DNA databases when it comes to felonies. But hey, this is Orange County. I know it sounds like, you know, Mayberry RFD or the Andy Rooney show with Barney Fife saying, hey, you want to spit in this cup and I'll let it go away. But obviously, civil libertarians have been staring at this with aghast for over 15 years.
Well, I mean, and a lawsuit was filed back in February by a couple of UC Irvine law professors. What do they say in their lawsuit?
Oh, this is completely unconstitutional. It's a waste of taxpayer money, and it's just an abomination to justice. This idea that the Orange County District Attorney's Office can have the secretive DNA, which, by the way, doesn't connect with other databases in the United States, because other databases would laugh at the idea of getting this DNA off of misdemeanors. So they're telling the court that this should be outlawed, this should be kicked out, and all this DNA should be dropped.
I mean, I mentioned walking your dog, right? Misdemeanor. That's an example that one of the professors, William Thompson, brings up. What happened in that case? This is from an article in The Intercept, right?
Yeah, so William Thompson's a professor emeritus at UCI School of criminologist at UCI, so he's retired. And a friend of his, literally in Irvine, which, by the way, they'll give you a ticket if you have the wrong type of car. Take it from someone who's had that ticket, by the way. She was walking the dog without a leash. She goes to the to the court, and she's confronted with multiple days and probably, you know, having to hire a lawyer, or you just give this DNA sample. So even though she didn't want to give the DNA sample, she just felt she felt she had no choice, because otherwise it was going to be a huge inconvenience to her life.
Todd Spitzer is Orange County's district attorney right now. As I mentioned, it began under Rakakis, but Spitzer was a critic of the program when he was running to replace Rakakis. What does he say now about the database?
Oh, he's saying it's wonderful and you need it to crack down on crime and to keep communities safe, which is incredible if you think about it, because Todd Spitzer forever ruthlessly savaged Tony Rakakis over everything, alleged he was corrupt, and that's how he campaigned and ended up winning over a snitch scandal. And as supervisor, as you said, Spitzer openly criticized this DNA program when it was approved throughout the time, and all of a sudden he found religion on it. I don't know, Todd, what happened?
You know, the woman walking her dog, Gustavo, I mean, she's not exactly posing a risk to public safety, right? So, I mean, isn't the point of a DNA database to capture people who, you know, could be dangerous, capture the DNA of people who could be dangerous to make sure that they don't do anything like that again, or at least have them in a database?
Todd's thinking is the same that Tony Rakakis had, which is like, well, if you commit a misdemeanor, you're most likely one day probably going to commit a felony. And when you commit that felony, you might try to disappear. And at least now we have your DNA to be able to match it. It's really specious thinking, but hey, it's Orange County justice for you.
Now, Spitzer, for his part, says that there have been some big cases that have been solved using the database. Is that true? Is he telling the truth?
That's what he says. So, and he's offered some cases as proof of that. But again, does that really justify 182,000 people who committed misdemeanors putting their spit into a database and Todd having, the OCDA having this DNA program for themselves and themselves alone? Todd, for years, campaigned on this idea of him being on the side of justice, on the side of the law. But a lot of critics are saying that's the antithesis of being for justice.
Who controls all this DNA information before we let you go?
OCDA, Todd Spitzer. He's the one who could plug in, see whatever he needs, give it to his prosecutors, do whatever needs to be possible to be able to get people that, you know, convicted or whatnot. But again, is it really worth it making people jump through hoops just because they say because they got a misdemeanor? No, Todd should be focusing on going after actual felons who commit felonies as opposed to people who committed misdemeanors and maybe one day probably won't commit any felonies.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times. Of course, he's here every week for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The Biden administration sounded the alarm today about a surge of COVID cases in some states and the direct connection with low vaccination rates. The Centers for Disease Control reported about 33,000 new COVID cases in the U.S. yesterday. That is a rise in new cases of about 70% compared with a week ago. Hospital admissions are up, too, by 36%. And the average death toll of the past week has climbed to 211 people a day. During a briefing today, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky and other top officials outlined the danger.
This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated. We are seeing outbreaks of cases in parts of the country that have low vaccination coverage because unvaccinated people are at risk.
One of the reasons for stubbornly low vaccination rates is misinformation, erroneous or outright false information that may dissuade some people from getting a shot. The White House has been particularly focused on this and the role of social media in allowing false information to spread. On his way to Camp David today, President Biden laid unmistakable blame on Facebook.
What's your message to platforms like Facebook?
They're killing people. I mean, it really, look, the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated. And they're killing people.
Facebook said the president was wrong. In a statement, the company said, quote, more than 2 billion people have viewed authoritative information from Facebook about COVID and vaccines, more than any other place on the internet. All of this comes as concerns over COVID are spiking regionally. This afternoon, Nevada officials recommended the use of masks in Las Vegas in crowded indoor spaces. The rise in cases and hospitalizations around the U.S. is particularly bad in parts of the South and the Midwest. That's where Lisa Desjardins picks up the story.
Judy, to get a sense of this,
Take a look at the map of hotspots where COVID cases are rising. 2 months ago, there were no red spots on this national map, but today there are a significant number of states that are red, representing new cases and positive tests. In fact, 7 of the 10 counties with the highest percentage of new cases per capita are in Missouri and Arkansas. And Arkansas's new cases have risen by 121% over the last 2 weeks. We look at the situation in that area and the concerns about the unvaccinated with an epidemiologist for the state of Arkansas, Dr. Jennifer Dillahay. Dr. Dillahay, take us into what the situation is right now with the coronavirus in your state.
Well, we are a state right now that has low vaccination rates. And at the same time, we're having a great deal of spread of the virus that causes COVID-19, but it's the new Delta variant, which is highly contagious. So it's leading to a surge in cases and a great increase in the number of hospitalizations in our state.
I want to talk more about the vaccination rate. You do have one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, about 35% of your population. What do you know about why that is?
It's multifactorial. Part of it is that people don't understand the urgency of being vaccinated. We're a rural state, so there were many rural communities that weren't really particularly affected this last winter. So they underestimate the potential for the disease to spread in their communities, and they're underestimating the infectiousness of the new Delta variant. And then on top of that, there is a great deal of misinformation out there, and people struggle with telling the difference between the misinformation and the accurate information. So they're unable to make an informed decision to get vaccinated because they struggle with understanding what the need is and what the risks are. And then on top of that, we have low healthcare providers in our state. We have underserved areas, so we have worked really hard to get vaccines out into the rural communities through our pharmacies, because oftentimes it's the pharmacies that's the only healthcare provider in the town.
On that idea of misinformation, we're seeing reports that sometimes there's even hostility now, people, including your governor, to presenting the facts about the dangers of the coronavirus. How do you combat that? At this point, you have put out the message. What can you do?
Well, I think one thing is to have empathy and compassion, and then to help people address their concerns about whatever they have. They need to be heard and then supported to move to a new position where they can accept new information.
You mentioned the Delta variant here. How dangerous do you believe that is?
I think that the Delta variant is very dangerous. It is highly contagious. It's very quick to put people in the hospital and at younger ages. So I think it's going to be hard for people to make decisions if they're basing those decisions on their experience of this past year. This is new, and people are underestimating it.
How are your hospitals doing right now with this surge?
So our hospitals are full, and not so much with COVID cases right now, but with cases that have resulted from delayed care or other health conditions that need immediate attention. And on top of that, the staff are tired. They have worked so hard over the last several months, and they're not getting a break, and they really need a break. We looked at our hospital numbers in the last several days. They're increasing every day for the past 2 weeks or more. And at the current rate of increase, we will double our hospitalizations by the beginning of August. And at that point, we will be at the peak in terms of our number of COVID hospitalizations where we were in the wintertime. It's very concerning.
You know, around that same time, just a month from now, is when freshman orientation begins at the University of Arkansas. Students will be back a few weeks after that. There is a home football game scheduled, tens of thousands of people. What is your concern level about that? Is there a conversation about whether those things should go forward?
So we do have a concern about those things, and it's really important for people to follow public health recommendations, which are, if they're not vaccinated, to wear masks and practice social distancing. I think in the current situation with schools starting, that's going to be very difficult for people to adhere to. And for that reason, we are strongly urging people to get vaccinated, get fully vaccinated as soon as possible.
A strong and important message, Dr. Jennifer Delahaye of the state of Arkansas. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The flood of death, as one German newspaper called it, has now claimed more than 100 lives in Germany, making it the country's worst natural disaster in more than half a century. Emergency teams are still searching for dozens of people who remain missing, including some caught up in a landslide. The floods, which inundated fields, roads and houses, affected other parts of Europe too, including Belgium, where at least 22 people died. Political leaders have pointed to the role of climate change. Here's the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier.
Sie haben mir mit erschütternden Worten von der Situation vor Ort berichtet.
They've told me in harrowing words about the situation on the ground, the suffering of people and the enormous extent of the damage. When the time comes, I will get an idea of the situation there, above all by talking with those affected. Only if we take up the fight against climate change decisively will we be able to keep extreme weather conditions such as we're experiencing now in check.
We'll hear more about what can be done in a moment, but first a look at how the flooding is affecting other European countries, starting with Switzerland and our correspondent Imogen Folks.
Here in the Swiss capital, Bern, the River Aare flows right through the city. And right now, you can probably hear it in the background, it's flowing at a record rate of 540 cubic metres every second. It's already burst its banks at the zoo, and yesterday some of the zoo's pelicans just floated away. Luckily, they've been found safe and sound 14 kilometres downriver. But people who live here are pinning their hopes on the huge orange inflatable barriers which began snaking through the town at the weekend. The Swiss invested millions in flood defences after the disastrous flooding of 2005. But right across the country, the water levels are rising. Lake Lucerne is flooding into the town. In Basel, residents have been told to keep well away from the River Rhine. And of course, in this alpine country, the other huge danger is mud and rock slides. Many road and rail links are closed. They're too risky to use, and it just keeps on raining. What's worrying people most is that back in 2005, they were told the floods were a once-in-a-century event, and yet just 16 years later, here we are again.
Imogen Folks in Switzerland. The Netherlands has so far avoided loss of life, but it couldn't escape the destructive waters, as I heard from Anna Holligan in Valkenburg.
I'm standing just on the edge of the river and a bridge has collapsed into the water. Three cars are submerged. This is one street in one town and it is a picture of devastation. So you can hear the firefighters are trying to pump the water out of the ground to access a gas pipe because there's currently a gas leak here. They're trying to attach a balloon there to stop the gas from leaking out any further. I'm just through the flood water you can hear. All of these homes have been evacuated. In fact, 10,000 people across this region have been sent elsewhere. Their homes are flooded, the basements. We went into to one home, the fridge was floating in the basement, flip-flops. At the front of every house, in fact, on this one street, there are sandbags. And in fact, some of them are just regular shopping bags filled with sand.
Yeah, what's late?
Hi. I'm walking round to the back of one home. This is Brigitte's home. And Brigitte was telling me earlier, she feels like she's one of the lucky ones because at least they survived.
We still got our living room from the third house from here. Living rooms all flooded, everything and higher. And they're all gone. Now, we've been trying 12 hours to keep the water out, but it didn't work.
Do you feel safe?
Well, at this moment, okay. Last days was just fear. We didn't sleep and just looking for what can we do? Can we do anything? Is it going to rise further? But no.
Valkenburg resident Brigitte. And Anna, the Netherlands has escaped relatively lightly compared to, say, Germany. But the destruction around you, that's going to take a long time to put right.
I mean, they can't even begin to count the cost at the moment. This has officially been declared a disaster zone by the Dutch government. And what that means in practice is that people will be able to access money from the state and not just their insurance companies, because it's thought the insurance companies just wouldn't be able to cope with this. And in fact, the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, is due here at some point today. Right now, they're cleaning up. They're trying to minimise the damage, but this will take days, possibly even weeks, to restore order to these streets, which are just absolutely flooded right now.
Anna Holligan in Valkenburg, near the Dutch, German and Belgian borders. So, a once-in-a-century event happening much more often. What's going on? I asked our chief environment correspondent, Justin Rolat.
Well, I mean, in simple terms, what we're seeing is what climate scientists have been saying for not just for years, but for decades is going to happen. We're seeing, you know, temperatures rise as we pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Higher temperatures, warmer air can hold more water in it. And therefore, we're seeing, you know, these pulses of extreme weather, of heavy rain. Heavy rain, if it's not kind of, if countries haven't adapted to deal with it, can, of course, cause flooding. And that's what we're seeing. So in that sense, there's a clear link. I mean, we need to wait until what they call an attribution study. The climate scientists kind of model how often events like this are likely to happen, and then can say with some certainty what the role of climate change in an individual event like this. We need to wait at least a few days for one of those to come through. So we can't say for certain about this event. But what we can say is this very much fits the pattern that climate change scientists say we should expect if we continue to pump huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which is, of course, what we're doing.
Our chief environment correspondent, Justin Rolat.
I want to be a cop. Tonight's top story, a father and son accused of storming the Capitol during the riots. Both are former police officers. One used to work for the Apopka PD, the other for Windermere Police. Good evening, I'm John Brown.
And I'm Amy Kaufeld in for Luann tonight. Well, it turns out it was their own brothers and sisters in blue who turned them in. Fox City 5's Holly Bristow has been digging deeper into their arrest, and she joins us live tonight with the very latest. Hi, Holly.
Good evening. Well, we did learn tonight that a fellow officer at the Windermere Police Department had contacted a supervisor concerned about what they believed Officer Kevin Tuck's involvement could have been in the Capitol riots. And when the upper brass at the department asked him about it, he said he was never in the Capitol building.
Can you tell us how you feel about your arrest?
Two now former police officers walking out of federal court this afternoon as suspects. The father-son duo charged for their alleged involvement in the storming of the Capitol back in January.
They're saying you were in the building. Were you in there?
51-year-old Kevin Tuck, the father, had been working for Windermere Police at the time of the Capitol riots. According to a release sent out by Police Chief Dave Ogden, a fellow officer brought up concerns about Kevin Tuck's potential involvement to a supervisor. January 11th, Windermere PD initiated contact with the FBI, but according to the release, at that point, the FBI had no knowledge of Tuck's involvement. July 7th, the FBI contacted Windermere Police's Chief Ogden, advising him an arrest warrant was being secured for Kevin Tuck. July 14th, the feds asked Chief Ogden to review photographs of Kevin Tuck at the Capitol. July 15th, today, Officer Tuck arrested at Windermere Police Department, at which time he resigned. Kevin Tuck's 29-year-old son, Nathaniel, also a former officer. He worked for Apopka PD until last year. Both men charged with obstruction of an official proceeding, aiding and abetting, entering and remaining in a restricted building, disorderly and disruptive conduct in a restricted building, entering and remaining in the gallery of Congress, disorderly conduct in a Capitol building, parading, demonstrating, or picketing. Nathaniel Tuck is also charged with resisting arrest.
Do you feel these charges are warranted?
Now, until we get our hands on the official arrest affidavits for both of those men, we won't know the exact details of exactly what they are accused of. What I can tell you, though, is that according to the statement sent out by the Windermere Police Chief, Officer Kevin Tuck only admitted to going up to D.C. for a political rally. For now, reporting live at the federal courthouse, Holly Bristow, Fox 35 News.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade. So you just heard the report, good old Kevin Tuck. We were hearing about his adventures in Washington, D.C. So I was on the news site just to get the audio for that report, and then I glanced to the right margin, and you know how they'll have other reports for the week. This was on the right in other local Florida news.
Orange County's Regional History Center says Central Florida is home to this country's largest incident of voting day violence ever, the Ocoee Massacre.
It's history often untold, often unknown, but no longer. A new bill requires all Florida students learn about it, and that new curriculum hits classrooms this upcoming school year.
My ethnic background consists of African American and Native American. A lot of the tribal and cultural people pass their history down through oral storytelling, through dancing.
Amber Saunders is an Orange County mom of three, her youngest now starting the eighth grade. Given her Native culture's deep reliance on and respect for history, she's excited about an addition to her daughter's school district's history curriculum. It's history she only knew little about.
I have heard of the Ocoee Massacre. I've heard of it in passing. I didn't really understand it and know the specifics of it.
The Ocoee Massacre happened on Election Day, November 2nd, 1920, after a black farmer tried to vote but was turned away. An armed, angry mob went looking for him but ended up lynching his friend, July Perry, attacking black neighborhoods, killing about 50 residents, burning homes and churches, all because they wanted to vote. It's history all Floridians should know about, but don't. However, that's about to change thanks to Florida House Bill 1213. It's a bill that, in part, requires all Florida students learn about the Ocoee Massacre.
I think it's important that our students, just know that it happened. This is something that happened to a group of people that lived in a city really close to where you live.
Rebecca Ray is the Orange County School System's Director of Secondary Curriculum Instruction.
So House Bill 1213 really called on the Education Commissioner, African American History Task Force, to consider ways and make recommendations for us to infuse the Ocoee Massacre into our already required African American history instruction.
But what specifically will it look like? And when specifically will it hit classrooms? Wesh Chu learned there are really no definitive answers just yet.
The one requirement is that it has to be taught starting this year.
State Senator Randolph Bracey helped sponsor the legislation.
The purpose was to give each school district the flexibility to figure out how they want to implement it.
We reached out to all of our local school districts and learned that they are aware of the legislation and are in the process of planning it out together, a group effort that will most likely result in the curriculums looking pretty similar across counties. And whatever the final curriculum ends up being, OCPS says it will be age and grade appropriate.
And we're that K-5 realm, you're thinking communities, geography, how do we kind of incorporate those aspects of what happened in Ocoee to their age band. In middle school, we cover voting right amendments. We cover political parties. We cover voting acts and things like that.
In high school, a little deeper.
How do we move forward from that? What are the societal implications? Like, what has played out in Orlando since then?
But a big part of the curriculum planning, professional development for teachers.
We're realizing that local Floridians don't know that this event occurred. So we have to bring that first to our teachers, because otherwise they can't go into their classrooms and successfully teach.
When did you find out about the Ocoee Massacre?
Oh, I feel like I didn't know about it until really it came from House Bill 1213.
But Bracey, Ray, and Saunders are hopeful.
Learning and understanding that we come from people who had built and developed a community where it was thriving and overcome certain things and setbacks at that time. I feel like it shows advancement. It shows advancement in our education system. I feel like it shows advancement as far as what we're teaching our children.
Now, Orange County says it is pushing to get this curriculum into classrooms prior to the 101st anniversary of the Ocoee massacre, which is in November. We, of course, will keep you posted on their progress.
Yeah, a lot of work still to be done on this.
Yeah, but they're inching along.
They're moving ahead.
More than 200 people have been arrested in South Africa following violence which was sparked by the detention of the former president, Jacob Zuma, for refusing to appear before a corruption inquiry. The army is being deployed to help quell the trouble, which has mainly been in KwaZulu-Natal province, the home of the 79-year-old former anti-apartheid fighter. Our correspondent, Nomsa Maseko, is in Pietermaritzburg, the provincial capital.
Police are investigating a number of deaths, and quite a number of people have also been arrested, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, in the province where I am now, and in South Africa's economic hub of Gauteng. And in just the last hour, the government has announced the deployment of the military. And here in Pietermaritzburg, where I am, I can see soldiers already patrolling the streets.
And what's the mood like where you are? Does it feel tense?
It is very tense. The situation is volatile. In fact, just in the last couple of minutes, we saw people looting a liquor store here. You would know that South Africa is under level 4 lockdown of the COVID regulations, and alcohol sales are not allowed. And people are now looting at a liquor shop. And we saw police getting in, firing warning shots in the air, trying to stop people from looting. But it continues unabated, and it's not just here where I am in Pietermaritzburg, but it is in most areas here in the province of KwaZulu-Natal. Just the last hour, I was actually also in another shopping center. A whole shopping center was looted and set alight. So all of this is happening here. It looks like police are overwhelmed, and that is why we think that the government saw it fit to deploy the military.
And is the detention of Jacob Zuma the only reason for this violence, or are there other wider issues going on too?
Well, we saw protests, starting up the day the former president was imprisoned, which was last Wednesday, where, in fact, his own supporters, pro-Zuma protesters, warning that there would be violence if the former president were to be imprisoned. The imprisonment came to pass, and here it is, the violence that was threatened just a few days ago. But this is leading to people thinking that this is now beyond just about Jacob Zuma. This is just elements of criminality that, opportunistic, elements that saw an opportunity because of the protests that, we are currently seeing in South Africa.
And the High Court due to announce the result of a review into its decision to jail Jacob Zuma later today. So he could be freed, couldn't he?
At this stage, highly unlikely. Because it does look like the court process is not going to take just one day. Because there are also interested parties besides Jacob Zuma's lawyers himself, saying that, him being sentenced to a direct prison sentence is equal to a death sentence because he's 79 years old, he's already sickly. But there are other interested parties in the form of NGOs who are defending the judiciary here in South Africa, and that they are saying that just because Mr. Zuma is a powerful politician, it doesn't mean that he should be released just because his supporters say so and are demanding it.
Well, Haiti is on the list of what's supposed to be. Haiti, the people who are called Haitians, predominantly are people who are classified as non-white, but they're not supposed to ever have anything under the system of white supremacy, except punishment
yeah.
for being arrogant enough under Toussaint to think that you, with your military skills, can take us over or tell us what to do. So many a historian has said that the reason Haiti is in the shape that it's in now, and sort of like the head wagging people of the world, you might say. Mm-hmm. Everybody kind of looks on them with great pity. It's because the white supremacists made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make examples of you. Don't you ever think that you can have military force against me, us white supremacists of the world. And we're going to make a perennial example of you up until the point we decide that we are not going to make that example. But you're going to be in poverty. You're going to be pitiful. You're going to be beggars of the first order. You're going to be dislocated trying to find a place to go because you can't stand being where you are, because I'm going to see to it that where you are will never be anything.
Now to the crisis in Haiti. It has been less than a week since the shocking assassination of Haiti's president by gunmen who broke into his home. Now a possible conspiracy involving a Haitian-born doctor living in Florida has further roiled an already fraught situation. All this as political rivals jockey for power. There is now a new lead suspect in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Haitian authorities said over the weekend that he is this man, 63-year-old Christian Emmanuel Sanon, a Haitian-American who lives in Florida. In 2011, he appeared to promote himself as a leader for Haiti.
With me in power, you're going to have to tell me, what are you doing with my uranium? What you going to do with the oil that we have in the country? What you going to do with the gold that you want to explore?
Police Chief Leon Charles said Sanon had arrived in Haiti in June. In a search of Sanon's home, officers found weapons, bullets, and a hat with an emblem from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. Video shot at the scene of the crime appeared to show someone purporting to be a DEA agent. Charles said Sanon was in police custody.
He arrived in Haiti on a private airplane to fulfill political objective. He has contacted a company specializing in security to recruit some bandits.
Haitian authorities have arrested 23 Colombians and two Haitian Americans they say carried out the attack. Colombia's police chief said a Florida-based security company, CTU, bought 19 plane tickets for the Colombian assailants, many of whom were retired soldiers. The tickets were from Bogota, Colombia, to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. From there, the assailants allegedly crossed over the border into Haiti. Meanwhile, the power struggle continued in Haiti. Two men each say they are the rightful prime minister of Haiti. Claude Joseph had the role when Moïse was killed, but a successor, Ariel Henry, was supposed to take over that day. Joseph's opponents are already calling for his ouster.
We consider him as a usurper who should be in jail.
Remaining members of the mostly disbanded Haitian Senate voted on their leader, Joseph Lambert, to serve as acting president. The White House said a U.S. delegation met with all three men on Sunday. Haiti's powerful gangs also seem to be taking advantage of the power vacuum. Notorious leader Jimmy Cherizier, known as Barbecue, urged gangs to avenge the president's death.
Mobilize.
I ask all the gangs to mobilize. Take to the streets. We demand explanations about the assassination of the president.
Port-au-Prince resident Yvens Rumbold said that Moise's murder has led to fear on the streets.
The feeling is, if the president can be assassinated at his home, so everything can happen to anyone in this country.
In the midst of the chaos, Haiti still has presidential elections, which the United States says should proceed. President Biden spoke this afternoon.
The people of Haiti deserve peace and security, and Haiti's political leaders need to come together for the good of their country.
We turn now to Eduardo Gamarra, professor of political science at Florida International University. He has written widely on Haiti, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Professor Gamarra, thank you so much for talking with us. First of all, what do you make of this new information about the Haitian American who says he's a doctor living in Florida, who's now been arrested?
Well, I think it signifies more than anything else the wide net of conspiracy that really led to the murder of President Moïse. And it also involves, obviously, a significant component of the Haitian private sector. This man other than saying he's a doctor, also claims to be a business person. So that probably leads to a whole series of other names that will come up in the next few days that will help us more readily identify who financed this operation.
You mentioned the Haitian private sector, the business community in Haiti. What would be the motive for them to get rid of President Moïse?
Well, the unfortunate fact is that President Moïse was unpopular across the spectrum in Haiti. But he also stepped on a few toes in the private sector, was facing the wrath of some of the most important business people who not only were his political opponents, but who also, in essence, pledged to have him removed.
And what you're saying is it may be difficult to draw a line between what they may have said about him and what finally happened to him.
Exactly. That's the most difficult part to decipher. And so I think that, you know, in a sense, there were so many different, how should I put it, gangs already in place in Haiti, funded by different actors. Gangs are related to drug trafficking, simple gangs related to street neighborhoods, for example. But also, and this is very important, a pattern that we had begun seeing in Haiti around the turn of the century of foreign security teams coming in to provide different sorts of security for ministers, for the president, or for the private sector, for that matter.
Do you think Haiti law enforcement will ultimately get to the bottom of who did this?
Well, what's surprising is that given the weakness of the non-existent judiciary, but also the fact that the police is essentially dismantled, that they got to so quickly to the culprits, that they arrested so many of the mercenaries, and that they are really moving fairly quickly in terms of finding out who financed this operation.
Professor Gamar, what about the political piece of this? There are now, what, three people, different people, who are saying they should be in charge, who may be laying claim to being prime minister. Where do you see this? How do you see this playing itself out?
This is going to be probably determined largely by who the international community supports. And as of right now, it has been the prime minister who was nominated in April, but who was essentially replaced by President Moïse on Monday of last week. But the international community is putting their support behind that gentleman, Mr. Joseph. So I imagine that that's where the direction, at least politically, that Haiti will take. But again, even in that context, holding elections in Haiti, which I think is what the international community expects, is going to be difficult given the fact that things are so unraveled at the moment and that really there appears to be chaos, at least in Port-au-Prince.
I was struck that you told my colleague, our producer, Dan Segallen, that when he asked you if Haiti's a failed state, you said you can't have a failed state when there's no state. I mean, did you mean that?
Yes. Unfortunately, Haiti has been in a very precarious situation in terms of institution building, and probably going back since the collapse of the Duvalier regime in the middle of the 1980s. This is a transition to democracy that never really gelled, that never was able to produce political parties, stable institutions, even a constitutional regime. And in the context of natural catastrophes and recurring political crises, what you've had is complete political implosion. And so here we are now with two prime ministers who, you know, in a parliamentary system that, with a parliament that doesn't exist, with a judiciary that's collapsed, with a police that's essentially half of what it used to be 4 years ago, with no armed forces, with no institutionality. It's very difficult to see the presence of a state.
Such a difficult set of circumstances. Professor Eduardo Gamarra, Florida International University, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Judy.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention. We need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the white collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
Baltimore County man is behind bars after a road rage situation escalated into an alleged assault involving a handgun and a racial slur. WMER2 News' Jeff Hager has more on this incident for us tonight.
Two cars bound for work during the early morning commute when police say a Dundalk woman noticed the other vehicle tailgating her on eastbound White Marsh Boulevard. She changed lanes, and both cars stopped side by side for a red light at Perry Hall Boulevard.
According to the victim, another driver pulled up, pointed a gun at the family, and threatened to shoot the woman. We're talking about a woman who's 8 months pregnant, two kids in the back seat, and her husband in this car.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
According to the victim, another driver pulled up, pointed a gun at the family, and threatened to shoot the woman. We're talking about a woman who's 8 months pregnant, two kids in the back seat, and her husband in this car.
The white driver allegedly also used profanity and the N-word in threatening the family.
Nigga!
As he drove ahead of the victims when the light turned green, he began changing lanes, blocking their path in an apparent bid to make them crash their car. The woman managed to take a picture of his vehicle with her cell phone and called to report the incident to police, who would later learn the motive for the assault.
Our officers had a chance to track down the suspect, and it sounds as if this driver was on his way to work, was potentially running late and in a rush.
Ironically, the suspect, identified as 44-year-old John Monks, is also married with two children. In Baltimore County, Jeff Hager, WMAR 2 News.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. Just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
A Fort Valley councilman under fire after being accused of threatening to shoot a woman in the face while using racial slurs at a laundromat, according to officials. This event resulted in an official complaint being filed for terroristic threats. WGXA's Brittany Miller joins us now after sitting down with the Fort Valley mayor to get her take on the accusations against her colleague, Brittany.
Greg, Mayor Barbara Williams says this isn't a reflection of Fort Valley's leadership. It's a reflection on Councilman Barnes' character. She does believe, though, that city leaders should be held to a higher standard.
Fort Valley Councilman Jimmy Barnes is accused of threatening to shoot a woman in the face and using racial slurs at a laundromat, according to an incident report from the Peach County Sheriff's Office. Mayor Barbara Williams says the accusations didn't surprise her.
In the heat of the moment, things happen a lot, and I'm not justifying it, and I'm not saying it was right. But in the heat of the moment, things happen.
According to the report, the victim was at the Highway 49 Food Mart, where she witnessed Councilman Barnes talking to people. As the woman was exiting the nearby laundromat, Barnes came in, had words with her, and then, according to the report, threatened to shoot the woman in the face while repeatedly calling her derogatory names. Then the woman slapped him.
We have to try to work on de-escalating things when it's in the heat of the moment.
A complaint for terroristic threats was filed, according to officials. The case is being investigated by the Peach County Sheriff's Office to avoid conflicts of interest, according to Mayor Williams. Now the council and the councilman at the center of the accusation are waiting to hear whether District Attorney Anita R. Howard will move forward with charges.
And if the charges are filed and is proven to be guilty, yes, it would be an ethical violation.
An ethics board would come together, and depending on what the final charges are, if any, Barnes could be censured, asked to resign, or removed from office. On the Fort Valley elected officials' webpage, Councilman Barnes' picture is no longer posted. The mayor says that's not because of these accusations. In fact, she says she hasn't formed a full opinion on the incident because it's still under investigation, and she's asking the public to do the same.
Rely on innocent until proven guilty. And when that happens, then we form our opinions. There are a lot of things that spread that way. There's a lot of blame being placed. Really on the city.
But because the mayor believes every council member is responsible for their own actions, she says there's only one outcome that would reflect poorly on Fort Valley's leaders.
If it turns out that there is some proof has been done, and of course that happens, and we don't do anything about it. That's the only thing.
And I spoke to Councilman Barnes this evening. He said he wants to tell his side of the story. However, he wants to make sure and clear it with his attorney before going on camera. In the studio, Brittany Miller, WGXA News.
This is dedicated to who it may concern. To be young, gifted, and black.
He's strong. He's a lot stronger than I was at that age.
Shortly after Devin Freeland graduated high school, he was brutally attacked for simply existing and now has one last dental surgery to endure.
It's definitely been hard seeing your son every day, you know, with a missing teeth and, you know, only 19 years old, and nobody should go through that.
Last summer, the Department of Justice says Lee Mowat targeted a group of black teenagers at Sterling State Park in Monroe. Using racial slurs, Mowat said the teens didn't belong there and attacked Devin, knocking out several teeth and fracturing his jaw. Devin's dad says he has only one question for the 43-year-old Newport man.
They're kids. You know, you're a grown man. You didn't have to, you know, swing a lock and hit my son in the face and could have killed him. My question to him would be, why?
Officials charged Mowat with a federal hate crime, saying the young victim in this case suffered tremendously from this vicious, racially motivated assault, and that hate-fueled incidents like this have no place in a civilized society.
In this day and age, you would think that people would be a little bit more kind and a little bit more loving towards one another, and, you know, we just see that that's not the case.
On Tuesday, Mowat pleaded guilty to willfully injuring the teen because of his race.
I'm glad that, you know, he did take the initiative to plead guilty. The justice part comes when we see exactly how much time he's going to do.
And Mowat's sentencing is in June. He's facing up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. I'm Priya Mann, Local 4 News Today.
context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 17, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Sometimes, I've said that for years. We've had the compensatory call in for more years than I can recall. And I've said, you know, we don't play these news segments randomly. You know, they are played in a specific order for a reason. So you can try to even maybe get a better understanding based on the order, chronology in which you hear these different reports. But I even had to pause myself and say, wait a minute, Gus, did I hear consecutive reports where a black female, some white person threatened to shoot them in the face? System of racism, white supremacy, terrorism, every single day. And one of them, 8 months pregnant. Shoot you in the face. I was going to be late to work. You out here acting a fool. Got these, what do they call it? The welfare queen. That's it. Got these welfare queens out here hogging up all the road. You and your nigger children. Get my gun and shoot you right in the face. Terror. And that would be another one when they try and say this is white privilege. Bias. Call things by their proper name. If we're out threatening pregnant black mothers, like 8 months pregnant, threatening to shoot them in the face, call it what it is. Let's see. So many things happened this week. We have the Global Sunday Talk on Racism tomorrow. So many things happened internationally. The assassination of the Haitian president. They have been rioting in both Cuba and South Africa, both areas of the world, so-called. It's just been amazing. What's going on in Cuba? So many things to talk about. They got mad at the black football players over. They had the European Cup soccer tournament, you know, this past weekend. Got mad, blamed it on the black guys that, you know, we lost the Euro Cup. It is what a week for international racism, white supremacy. But that'll be tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Whew. It is not just a local problem. What does it mean all around the world to be classified as white? Next, list of things lengthy. Number one, I'll start where we get to end. What is that idiot he tells me? He said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Now, we didn't play any audio segments about this. We had that report on cancer at the beginning, but they had a segment, North Carolina Radio, WFAE, Scotty Reed's part of the plantation, alcohol use linked to over 740,000 cancer cases last year. A new study says that's nearly a million. Miss C down in South Carolina, one portion of the report that she found noteworthy: ethanol, the form of alcohol present in beer, wine, and liquor, breaks down to form a known carcinogen called acetaldehyde, which damages DNA and interferes with cells' ability to repair the damage. Alcohol can also increase levels of hormones including estrogen. Hormones signal cells to grow and divide. With more cell division, there are more opportunities for cancer to develop. Alcohol also reduces the body's ability to absorb certain cancer protective nutrients, including vitamins A, C, D, E, and folate. Noteworthy indeed. What did he say? He says sobriety would be best. Continuing. Oh my gosh. This has been the worst year. So I certainly am not advocating any form of football, right? Soccer, American football, whatever, for white people's ball games. We got bigger problems. Let's see the Olympics. Now, Richard Sherman was on the Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks team. Memorable because we talked about his performance specifically on neutralizing workplace, on the cows, because he got accused of yelling in the vicinity of a white woman. And oh my gosh, was he going to rape her out in the middle of the field? This was at the NFC Championship game, I believe 2013, San Francisco 49ers. Ironic because he later played for them. Anyway. So lots of racism, white supremacy throughout his career. I remember they had sketches from that moment of Richard Sherman looking like the Predator because he's got locks and all that. Anyway, so I get up. I think this is like Wednesday. Well, the date for this report is July 14. So I woke up middle of the week. Cornerback Richard Sherman in custody after arrest at in-law's home. Car accident. Oh, I start reading. Free agent cornerback Richard Sherman is facing several charges, including one on suspicion of burglary, domestic violence, after he was arrested at his wife's parents' residence in Redmond, Washington, early Wednesday. Redmond Police Department Chief Daryl Lowe said at a news conference Wednesday that Sherman also faces charges of suspicion of resisting arrest and malicious mischief. I think Mr. Fuller says comply. No fighting, no fleeing, no fussing. Calm all that down. In addition, Washington State Patrol Captain Ron Mead said at the news conference that his department is also ready to refer Sherman to prosecutors for possible misdemeanor DUI and hit and run charges related to a separate incident Wednesday. What did that moron just say? Sobriety would be best. And it got worse. Sherman sustained minor lacerations to a lower leg and ankle and was treated at a local hospital as a result of contact from a police dog, which was used in his apprehension, Lowe said. First time, last time. I wouldn't care how many Super Bowl rings the person has, how big their bank account is. First time, last time. That I'm not a Seahawks fan by any, like, whatever your thoughts are. I've been in Seattle for a long time. I think every time they've gone to the Super Bowl, I have been in Seattle. The cows didn't exist for the first one, but for all the rest, right here, we were broadcasting, I think, for all of their Super Bowl triumphs and losses, except for the first one. All of that said, what I just said, Gus T was not here, painted neon green and blue. Go, Russell Wilson. Go. Get it. Go, Marshawn. Not at all. Most of the time, I was doing the exact same thing I'm doing right now. Broadcasting. Attempted counter-racism. So I'm not a Seahawks lackey. But Richard Sherman had talked about racism. And because of him, we had talked about racism. And then they put the police. Oh, just the worst of it. This has been the worst year. Even way worse than 2020. Like, way worse. I can't say it enough. First time, last time. You really do not want things to get so out of hand that whites and their canines, freaking white dog, has to show up and chomp on you. Whew. Better days on the plantation. Continuing. Let's see. I had a lengthy list. There were so many things. I didn't even get to the things that we played in the reports yet. All right. From the reports. The first report on cancer, I was going to start with Black Panther. Oh, his name is Chadwick Boseman. Chadwick Boseman. 2020 was not good either. I was going to start with Chadwick Boseman. Then I switched around. I couldn't make up my mind. Either way, so much of that with cancer. Sobriety would be best, leaving that alcohol alone. But what you eat, getting exercise, trying to minimize the toxins and poisons that are around you that you're ingesting on a regular basis. We talk about that on a regular basis, but they started off with that, with people missing their cancer screenings and what have you because of the pandemic over the past 2 years, year and a half, whatever. So next they had the segment. Melissa Harris Perry. I'd said yesterday I'm not playing any more of her segments, and this was just more evidence. I had selected this segment before I made that statement yesterday. Now I have every reason to stick through it. I could just weed through her reports. Victims guaranteed qualified. I just don't find her content constructive. People make the same assessment of Gus T. I tell them the same thing. Do not listen to the context of white supremacy. No problem. The segment that we did endure, she had Mr. McWhirter on, who I believe is a black male victim of white supremacy, so they both get victims guaranteed qualified. But they were talking, and he specifically, Mr. McWhirter, he said that the Anglo-leftist culture, in fact, before I even get to that, the metaphor that was used repeatedly was policing, and I said, that right there. I do not agree even with the use of that word, because if we're talking about so-called policing language, I have not seen anyone where Gus T says, I don't think we should use the word privilege. I already said it today. We shouldn't be calling this privilege. If we're talking about shooting a pregnant black, if we're talking about shooting an 8 months pregnant black female in the face, that's not privilege. That's not bias. That's not discrimination. Call it what it is. White terrorism. That's not policing, because people like Timothy Wise and Jane Elliott and legions, they just go right on white privilege and white privilege and implicit bias and blah, 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 blah. Okay. I do not have the authority to police and go out and arrest them and break in the door and George Floyd. That doesn't happen. And I've not seen that happen anywhere where, based on someone saying something and a so-called Anglo-leftist culture, whatever that all means, someone or even a non-white predator. I mean, we're really getting goofy now. Imagine that, Al Sharpton going to rough somebody up. Don't you call us refugees no more. We're citizens. I don't remember that after Hurricane Katrina. If they got video of this happening, someone being arrested, you know, calling us refugees or any of the rest of it, share. So it's not policing. If it's someone making a critique or a suggestion about something being inappropriate. And I mean, even he kept saying it goes too far. You're taking things away. It goes too far. He even said it's an inhuman way of treating people who use language. George Floyd, I think, putting your knee on someone's neck and killing them is inhuman. Making a critique or request about the way we use language is pretty. In fact, he said Anglo-leftist culture. I don't know what that means. You got individuals who are classified as white and practice racism. Like they said in Texas, take the word justice out of the school book. We've had others with take the word slavery out. Don't call them slaves. Call them immigrant workers. Yes. Don't call them slaves. No one does a better job critiquing and manipulating the use of words than white people. No one. Horrendous segment. Maybe one of the last times we hear Melissa Harris Perry on the broadcast. It's been years since we even had her show. Next. when they talked about geocaching, I'd never heard of that before. So they have whole black family, black male, they're on and they're going out, and I guess you use your coordinates to try to locate these items. I could see some constructive value to that. Like they say, a lot of people have difficulty with like maps and geography and coordinates and all of that. So I could see if you can do that with your children, you're getting some exercise and, you know, learning how to read maps and geography. You can find things different places that you go. No problem with any of that. In the segment, so this fella, he says that, man, they had on this message board that, you know, people were asking, have you been stopped by the police when you're out geocaching? And everyone was like, no, never. What are you talking about? And he said, wow, I've only been doing this 6 months and I've been stopped 7 times. That's more than once per month. Then he said, sometimes I get stopped by the police. Sometimes it's just a random white person. Again, what does that moron say? He says, sometimes it's a race soldier with a badge. Sometimes they don't have a badge. He also said he thought it was constructive. I'll say he didn't use the word constructive, but he thought he found some value in being in these locations where you're not supposed to be, as though that proves something to white people. Victims guaranteed qualified. Again, get out and do constructive things. If you're the only victim there, do so. But I don't think it proves anything or is of any value. I think in a system of white supremacy, non-white people generally are warehoused or allowed to be in areas where they don't have lots of constructive resources, might not even be safe to geocache. Let's see, next. In even the same segment as geocaching, they said that he had developed lots of tricks to avoid racism, white supremacy. They didn't say it that way, but that's the way I'm saying it. And even I thought that, and you want to talk about use of language, this is policing language. It's, they didn't say he had developed codes. Codification, really, right? They didn't say that. Strategies. Tips. They didn't say that. They said he had developed tricks. Even that is significant because black people are often thought particularly, you know. Anyway, they generally think of black as something conniving, deceptive, mischievous. They even talked about Johnny Cochran that way, something kind of slick about his demeanor, his presentation. He's kind of a trickster up there with these words and things. Always some sort of implication of something sinister and untoward. Again, it couldn't be that he's developing counter-racist codification, because that's what it sounded like to me. And pitiful, this is not a critique of him, but I mean, that is so pitiful. You're out doing this game, could be doing it by yourself or with your children, and gotta make sure I bring my clipboard along, make sure I look like I'm a working Negro and not just out here. And what are you doing poking around in our neighborhood? Get George Zimmerman metaphor. Let's see, next one. They got to the CRISPR report. We only have one of those. So we got to the CRISPR report. And they messed up my... Okay, got it back. Messed up my audio briefly. Messed up my headphones, sorry. So we got to the CRISPR report. They're talking about setting these guidelines that people will be requested to follow, no means of enforcing, which I thought was important that they conceded. But these are guidelines people are supposed to follow about the CRISPR, ever-advancing CRISPR technology, which was mentioned by the young victim of white supremacy who won the spelling bee. I have to get her name, Zalia Avant-Garde. She had just talked about that also. But I thought it was important. We got the same metaphor there. They said that with the CRISPR, darkest case, the worst case scenario, again, associating something bad with black. Same thing I said about throwing shade. Next, now, the flooding that happened in Europe. I'm certain that all of the Cows listeners are not believers in what they call climate change, that some of the polluting and detoxifying of the planet that race soldiers have done is disrupting the very climate throughout the planet that we call Earth. I'm sure that everyone does not agree with that. I would say being in Seattle, for that heat wave that they said is a 1 in 1,000 year event that we just experienced, and when they say Seattle in recorded white history has a total of 6 100-degree days, 3 of those 100-degree days were the final Saturday of June, the final Sunday of June, and the final Monday of June 2021. It would give you pause. That is an anecdote. All of that said, the flooding in Europe, they said this is the worst natural disaster, in quotes, in Germany in more than a half century. That's, I think, for a lot of our listeners and such, that would be our lifetimes for a lot of folks. Like, what I was thinking really with that and CRISPR, remembering Judith and Lacing, where they were talking about the birth dearth, like, wow, if this climate destruction thing is legitimate and that's, you know, causing individuals problems. And then the number that they said specifically was by 2060, most 60% of the white males in North America and Europe, where the floods are, will be infertile. That's not even 40 years. All of that just to say, like, wow. I think we had said before, at least some of us, like, man, we might need divine intervention to help solve this problem. Like, wow. Just something to think about. I am not a scientist. Next. Speaking of science, I linked these. These are points were sequenced together. So we heard about the CRISPR technology, and then we heard California. I love California, but why? California as a state is very important. They have sent us presidents. And they frequently, a lot of the laws and things that happen there end up becoming laws in other parts of the country. Bellwether state, they call it. So in California, for them to have, they said they've had this for 15 years, a misdemeanor. As opposed to, you got to go through court and all these fines and all that. Just give us some of your DNA. We talked about this with Dorothy Roberts. This is in her third book, Fatal Invention. She was a guest on the program way back into, well, she repeatedly, but we talked about this specifically in 2011. She had lots of concerns, and she put this in the context of white supremacy. Who do enforcement officers seem like they want to go get their hands on? Let me get your fingerprints. Let me get some of your data. Let me get some of your spit. Let me get a little bit of your blood. Yes, yes, we need that, Tamir Rice. Give me that. We'll put that on file just in case. Never know what you're going to be by the time you get 20, if we allow you to live that long. Never know who you might want to rape, who you might want to mug, rob, steal, loot. Yes. Lots to consider. I don't know if we have listeners in California. Has anyone had that, like, proffered to them, like, for a misdemeanor or what have you? Like, man, we'll drop you. And that could be like loitering, anything silly. Like, they catch you outside. Oh, we got a gang out loitering after dark. We got you at the point that, yeah, trespassing on city property. You can go to court, or let us just give us a little bit of your genetic material. We'll call it square. Imagine being a young person and you're misinformed. I think Ivory was talking about her offspring. Imagine being like 17, 18, something like that, and you don't have parents with you, and you all haven't talked and everything, and they get you in that type of scenario. Whew. Let's see. Anything else? I told you I had lots of notes. I'll get in maybe two more. I'll do two more. Went the report where they talked about the white councilman who also threatened to shoot a non-white female in the face at the laundromat, no less. They went and talked to Mayor Williams, who is a black female. They had video for this. So they went and talked to Mayor Williams, and she said, I wasn't surprised when I heard about this, and I got excited, like, ooh, she was going to give us something juicy, like she knows this white fella. He's done this type of thing before or whatever, and that's not what she said. She said, in the heat of the moment, things can happen. People can say something. And I thought, oh, well, that is not victims guaranteed qualified. But oh no, I have been upset. I've had all kinds of things happen where somebody said something, or you know, I was disappointed by an appointment or got stuck in traffic. Had that happen this week? All kinds of things. I have not, in the heat of the moment, got agitated about traffic or anything else. See, you know, I'm so disgusted. I'm gonna pull out my gun and shoot you in the face. No, that has never happened. ever. And then to add on top of that, a racial slur, as they say. No, I have been upset. I have used a profanity or eight, but no, I have never threatened to kill someone, nor do I think that is, well, I can understand the heat of, no, that is a crime. What do they call anger management? You're just sounding like old Pitchfork Ben Tillman, sounding like a terrorist. I did have other things, but last thing I'll share for now, at least. Man, oh man, this has been the wackiest week. That's not even a great word. Let me retract. This has been one of the more stressful weeks of white supremacy racism on the plantation. I will have to do a full broadcast about this at some point later where I can process everything. Everything is still so raw. Plus, I'm one of those folks. I don't want to be like Mr. Fuller when he talks about where you get excited and start celebrating and you have not. The game is still going. You haven't even scored a touchdown yet and you start breaking out into your end zone celebration. Like, I don't want to be that type of victim of white supremacy. So once everything is settled and I've processed and escaped safely, I will have to give a more detailed report on what has transpired this week in the past few, maybe 20 days or so. Like, lots of counter-racist lessons. The one that I can give now, woo, so many. I guess if I could just give abbreviated, this is important just for in case anyone, if you're ever in a situation, I've learned painfully, but one of the lessons that I've learned, if there is a scenario where there's conflict, white person or non-white person, and it looks like this is us, it doesn't look like this is going to be something that's going to be resolved amicably. It looks like this might even escalate. Once it looks that way, the person who reports this incident first is usually in a better position. Generally, not always, but generally the person, if this is something that looks like enforcement officers are going to have to be called or whatever it is, even if we bring it back to a school level, like an educator, generally the person who reports this is going to be in a better position. The person who reports first. That's one. So on that basis, if you find yourself in a situation that looks like this is conflict, it doesn't seem to be abating, might even be escalating. If this happens at a residence where you are not the property owner, so if the police are called to the residence and who, you know, owns this house, whose name is on the mortgage or whatever it is. If that name isn't yours, so this could be a, you know, well, your name isn't on the lease or whatever, you know, pack your suitcase and beat it or, you know, whatever the case may be in that sort of situation. What I would recommend, the technique that I used, in fact, leave the residence and then call the police. We discussed this in the context of if things have gotten so bad where you think, man, I might need to call the enforcement officials. I might need to file a police report. Sometimes it might be better to go to the police to do that as opposed to calling them to your residence. We talked about that and how I believe several folks said, hey, they did that and it worked out much better. This is basically another permutation of that strategy where you can accomplish the same effect. They don't have to come to your residence. And if it's something where you're not the property owner, you can still get whatever assistance needed. And it won't be a, all right, pack your bag and get out of here because you don't. That was one that worked brilliantly, even with a white property owner. Brilliantly. Exit. and then call. The other component, like, whew, there was so much, whew, so much amazing counter-racism potentially. Again, no celebrating before, you know, things are done. But there was so much counter-racism that went on that Gus T got a individual classified as white to give not one but two different conversations between white people when there were no non-white people present, and white supremacy racism came up both times. Surprise. I will just share briefly one, and we'll have to leave it there. This will have to do a program on all this later. Whew. But the one, and this is just a portion of the one. So the portion of the one, we have a white woman, different white woman, who says she's talking to a different, like third different white woman. So they're chatting it up, and she says, you know, I'm all for giving black people a chance, and that's, you know, type of thing that I generally support. But, you know, I didn't want to be thought of as, what do they call it? And this is how it was explained to me, stuttering and all. What do they call it? Implicit bias. I think that's what they call it. Yeah, I didn't want people to think I had that implicit bias. Now, this white heifer, excuse me, does not stutter and has not stuttered in her life. Now, all of a sudden, when it comes time to pronounce implicit bias, she is stammering and stuttering, and I got a speech impediment. Woe is me, I can barely talk. Does not get any better than tacky. But wow, what a week. Or I guess it's been 20 days, but culminate. Whew. Have to talk about all that later. Wow. You cannot be ignorant about white supremacy racism if you are classified as white. Not possible at all. Number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, suggestions, that would be great. Just make sure everyone gets at least one chance to share. This broadcast is not for spectators, so hopefully you did not dial in just to sit and listen with all of the terrorism that we experienced. They're threatening to shoot black females left and right in the street with their whole family present in front of their children, pregnant or no. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. For this broadcast specifically, if we could not use metaphors, dark scenario with the CRISPR policing, with the words frequently race soldiers, white people will use metaphors to practice deception. Victims, we're still learning, many of us, Gus T included, sometimes we haven't come to a conclusion. We don't have all the information we need, so sometimes we'll swap, use a metaphor, analogy, comparison, whatever it is, in place of logic. Frequently, that contributes to more confusion. If we can make an effort to be specific, precise, exact, I would appreciate it. Again, if you know you're in a noisy environment, use your mute button. Try to get to a quieter area if possible. Just helps if we do not have to have a lot of unnecessary background noise to compete with. Much obliged. We'll hit the phone lines. First few folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everybody. Just wanted to briefly talk about two subjects, starting with Mr. Sherman. has very little to do with football. Primarily is a conflict between black male and his quote unquote wife, and ultimately in some kind of way the in-laws were involved also. There is a nut that says sobriety is best and makes a habit of saying it. It is a correct or a correctly suggestible understanding. Anger, alternate substances, conflicts your ability to think. And anger is an emotion. And I don't know anybody that does not demonstrate that at some point in time. But you have to keep it under control. You have to keep the anger under control to whereas your thinking would not be compromised. The only thing I know is Mr. Sherman was angry. Mr. Fuller has suggested, and I think he's correct because he's being logical, when a non-white male and female makes the agreement to be under the same roof, it is not going to always be correct, or as the term he used, Shangri-La. There's going to be problems involved. I think also that should be some of the discussion that takes place between a male and a female before they get serious with one another. What do you suggest that you would do in times of conflict, ma'am, sir, or, you know, person by their first name or whatever, the kind of arrangement you would have in the question and answer period, that sort of thing. When you have that type of code, at least you in some degree would be prepared for what to do in that those type of situations. It certainly was a failure. The only good thing was that Mr. Sherman is still alive, and most of the offenses that he's being charged with now are primarily misdemeanors. It could have been worse. First of all, he could have gotten killed by his quote-unquote father-in-law, who did state to dispatchers that he had a firearm on the other end of the door that he was banging on. Then next, we know the relationship between law enforcement and black males. And you certainly are not going to be able to compromise or deal with a four-legged law enforcement officer. So it's best to not alter your means to think, especially when you get angry, so you can make better decisions. Whatever took place between Mr. Sherman, his wife, and in-laws. South Florida, as everybody knows, that there were protests that took place, well, there are still going on, protests that was going on down here involving, quote-unquote, Cuban immigrants. So-called in concert with people who are protesting over in Cuba itself. The contradiction is the governor of the state of Florida instituted a law that made blocking major highways and expressways a crime. I knew ahead of time that just because you have a law that doesn't mean it's going to be enforced. There is no way down here in South Florida that a law such as that is going to be enforced by agencies that are controlled by the very people who are protesting, which is white Cubans down here in South Florida. I knew that was not going to take place at all. I would not be surprised to look up and see that another major expressway, such as the Florida Turnpike, Palmetto Expressway, which is something like the second or third most frequent highway in South Florida, or I-95, which extends all the way up the East Coast, would be blocked in some sort of way at some point in time, as long as the same thing is going on over in the island of Cuba. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Great question. How do you handle conflict? Great question. That person tells you, I pull out of my gun and shoot him in the face. Say, thank you for telling me. You don't even go through the rest of the question. Let me get out of here as quick as possible. Hear what they say. Give me some examples when you've had conflict before and how you resolved it. Do you want to do better in the future? Do you think that worked well, or do you want to improve upon how you resolve conflict in so-called relationships or arrangements? Excellent question. Can learn a lot about a person right there. Even as a retired firefighter was kind of going over what happened with Mr. Sherman, and you know, he could have died, things could have been much worse, the police could have killed him, and his care mate's father could have killed him, lots of ways that could have been an immense tragedy, already terrible but greater. And I thought, he kept saying it's anger, you know, if he was under the influence, and you know, maybe that altered his state, and maybe he's able to calm down when he's sober. And maybe that wasn't the case this time. That's what I'm saying. Maybe that wasn't the case this time in terms of him being sober. Maybe he wasn't. So he didn't have the same ability to kind of release some of that aggression and kind of get himself back in a proper space and kind of make better decisions. As retired firefighter said, I started thinking, Richard Sherman has played a lot of football. That nut, in addition to saying sobriety would be best, does do a lot of talking against football and saying brain damage. I was thinking, is this one of those CTE symptoms, that anger that's uncontrolled and you're ready to go knock down a door and all the rest of it? And again, substance abuse could have been involved here. We don't know, but there is a record of them saying that this sort of reckless, raging behavior could be a side effect. Brain damage, another reason why you don't. I did say Super Bowl champion Richard Sherman, he's played in 3 different Super Bowls. Lots of football. I don't think you could play that long at that level and not have brain damage.
Yeah, but it normally doesn't occur. It normally doesn't occur during their career. It normally occurs, they start seeing symptoms years after their football careers are over. I haven't seen of an instance where it was definitely identified as CTE while the person was playing. I could be wrong, but I haven't seen.
I'm not a doctor. I think somebody said that a few times as well. I'm not a doctor, so certainly don't be, you know, listening to Gus T like I'm a medical expert on CTE and all the rest, because I am not. All of that said, I do think with Aaron Hernandez, they did say that's another one where he was quite young. I think even younger than Richard Sherman at the time of the murders and all of that, this might be another example of brain damage. So I'm not sure. I get the main thing, one thing I am sure of, I'm not a doctor. But I don't
but
think
it was after his career, correct?
Well, he was still playing. He was like 28. He was still playing when all that happened. He was, you know, still in the prime of his career. This was not after with Aaron Hernandez. No, this was not after his retirement. He was, I think, 28. And it's, I have to look to get the exact age. But no, he was very young when all of this happened, the murders and everything else, when he was convicted and all that. Lots to still
okay,
learning.
If it was, then I mean one guy over millions. I mean, I you know, it's not something that is common. I would just put it that way. Normally it doesn't show symptoms. The symptoms such as violent reactions and whatnot until years after that person's career is over. And I haven't done any research on that person, but I thought his career was over while he was being in prison. You know, so, but I haven't really studied it myself as far as that particular person.
Mr. Hernandez died at the age of 27 in greater confinement, and according to the, I mean, he was convicted, so this is not speculation. He committed these murders while he was still playing professional football for the New England Patriots, but he died at the age of 27, which is considerably younger than Richard Sherman is right now. But again, I'm not a doctor. Folks can research, come to their own conclusions. I'm sure there'll be lots more evidence and controversy about CT and all that. I don't think playing football helps. Sobriety would be best. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello.
Our caller in Georgia. I think the incident where the council member threatened the black female in the laundromat, that was in Georgia. Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Yes, it was. And I just called a good program, but thank you for that. Thank you for keeping me updated with what's going on in my area, because I've been trying to keep up with the news, and I missed that one. Then I looked online to see if it was on. It might have been in the paper. I don't get the paper because I have some other issues with them delivery and whatever with the paper. But online paper, I didn't see it there. They also had a story, I believe I told one before, about the guns, and they put all these black people who operate this thing operation. Then recently they had another operation in the area regarding meth. They said it was a sting. They found some guns, blah, blah, blah. No pictures. I'm like, I wonder why. Because I believe usually the thought is that making meth and all that is not something that people who are classified as black are known for say. So no pictures of those people, those perpetrators. Ray Clips, since you all were talking about CTE, I looked it up briefly. It says it's diagnosed after death. So no, I guess technically when you're playing, no one will know if it's diagnosed after death. So that could be why it was found so young in Mr. Hernandez, because he died so young. So I guess, you know, they're trying to do research for the symptoms, and I think you've had things on that talking about the funding for concussion protocols and all that kind of stuff. I think you had that on there. And I guess the thing about the words, I've heard that part. And what they call us, or what we quote unquote call ourselves, I find that it matters somewhat. I won't say it doesn't matter at all, but in the end, it's kind of what the white people call us, unfortunately, right now. That's kind of what we have to go with. I think that's all I have for right now. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, our caller in Georgia. Dr. Welsing, she used to always champion us to pay attention to the news locally, or pay attention to the system of white supremacy and news locally, nationally, globally, always reporting just to further confirm the system, white supremacy, that does exist. Yeah, I'm going to be checking the CT. I think she is correct. As I said, I'm not a doctor. They generally do diagnose this after the fact. That's when they go and can carve up the brain and see all of the things, like, oh my gosh, look what all these years of football have done, all that. Yeah, I think that she's absolutely correct in that. That's, and Mr. Hernandez died at 27, so they had access to his brain much earlier to dig out and see what exactly had happened for all of his New England Patriots days. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Zalia Avangard, the non-white black girl who won the spelling bee, much respect to her winning. But I find it interesting when I see her on the news, and she's getting a lot of news coverage, most of it is all about her dribbling and playing basketball. And I'm asking myself, didn't she win the spelling bee? I mean, it's almost like a footnote now that, you know, she won the spelling bee in most of the news coverage that she has. But, you know, it's like if you didn't know, you know, this girl, you would have thought she was like a top, you know, basketball player in her grade. But, you know, one of the reasons why she got the coverage is because she's the, you know, first non-white black girl to, you know, win the spelling bee. But it just seems like, you know, they focus on her athletics more than her intelligence. But, you know, that's how they portray us in media. In regards to Haiti and the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, getting assassinated, Haiti is basically a perfect example of why we should be codified as people. I'm a big studier of Haitian history, going back to the Haitian Revolution, and studying, you know, how their governments were in, you know, after the revolution. And it just seemed like, you know, there was a bunch of coups, assassinations. Basically, there were three assassinations to Haitian presidents, including the first leader of the Republic, Joaquin Dessalines, who was actually assassinated by his own generals. And, you know, it's, you know, just a perfect example of why we should, you know, be codified as people, you know, no name calling, no fighting, no killing, you know, each other. If they would have just followed those three simple rules, they will probably be a nation, you know, independent on themselves. Actually, and this is why, you know, the white run nations can come in and do what they do to this republic. You know, the United States has been running Haiti for like forever now. So and this is why they take advantage of the non-codifications of this nation. And this is why they are in chaos. And this is why their, you know, president has been assassinated. No less by different nations, including Colombia, biggest exporter of cocaine to all over the world. And Richard Sherman, it's, you know, just what retired firefighter said and you about, you know, sobriety, you know, and also possibly CTE. Now, remember, Richard Sherman is like a free agent, so he's not signed to a team. So he's kind of like, and he's also in his 30s, which is almost, you know, the end of the line for a football player. So this is something that, you know, we probably need to learn from as well. But I also wanted to contrast that to another case that I felt got minimized or didn't get much attention. Even though Richard Sherman's got, you know, breaking news attention about, you know, his case. And that's the case of Trevor Bauer,
the pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers, white male. And it's so funny, when he's accused of sexual assault, but when the news first came out about him, the headline said that he was put on administrative leave. But they never said a sexual assault until like a day later. And so I contrast that to that and the story of Deshaun Watson too, because, you know, Deshaun Watson just got, you know, he just, there was just full blown coverage about him and basically, you know, all kind of sexual allegations. Deshaun Watson, this, you know, he's been accused of sexually assaulting like 20 women now. And so I find it interesting how they minimized the Trevor Bauer assault case, kind of like what they did with Ben Roethlisberger a couple of years ago. So, but obviously, you know, white people get the benefit of the doubt. Black people, we are automatically rapists, whether we've been accused or not. So, especially black males. But that's all I have on my mind.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Incidentally, Richard Sherman is 33. So as you stated, as they call it in the NFL, a free agent, I mean, he's not currently signed to any team. 33 is real old for NFL players, generally speaking. You might have a few who get to hang out if you're at that special protected position quarterback, where you can be Tom Brady, generally someone classified as what, Ben Roethlisberger, where you can hang out till you're 40, 45 years old. But generally, the more athletic positions, cornerback, as Richard Sherman plays, 33, what's the metaphor? Long in the tooth. And now with major legal problems, as they say, hanging over your head, the other metaphor. The LA Times, they have a report on Trevor Bauer, just if folks haven't been following that story. It reads, and they're saying that he should be kicked from the team immediately, and saying that the Dodgers are not sending a good message by not kicking this guy off the team immediately. As Henry in Chicago said, got him on administrative leave, like he choked a black person or something. The LA Times, they write, it is a message that has been lost in all the legal shuffling and posturing that has occurred in the 2 weeks since a San Diego woman filed a temporary restraining order against Bauer, accompanied by a declaration filled with graphic photos, hospital records, and gory details. Bauer is currently on paid administrative leave while being investigated for alleged felony assault, after the woman accused him of choking her to the point of losing consciousness during two sexual encounters and punching her repeatedly during the second one. Bauer's representatives have said the encounters were consensual, even the punch. Don't know how that coverage would look if Mr. Bauer was a black person, but wow. Woo. I think it'd be a little different. Let's see. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks we missed totally who have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed. Folks taking a moment to get their thoughts together. Hopefully not too long. We have about 30 minutes left in the program. Please don't wait till the last moment if you have a hand up, comments to share. Again, we'll be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Racism. I'm pretty sure so many things happened internationally. Like, man, to hear the protest in South Africa, the racism with the Euro Cup, England. The protests in Cuba, the Rona situation. I wanted to hear that. They just dropped the restrictions, but they still got so much happening all over the world. The floods in Europe here. I mean, lots to talk about tomorrow. So 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Listener supported counter racist radio. Hit the blog. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. The link to my PayPal is in the top right corner. Cash App is also linked there. Cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested, supported 12 and a half years. Baker's Dozen, if we get to February. I hope we have provided constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works, things victims of racism can and should be doing to solve this problem. Some of it including what words we use, what words we don't use. Let's see. Other folks comment here they want to make sure they get in. Folks we missed totally.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I was also thinking about that. I didn't necessarily get to hear the whole audio segment. I was trying to get some things done. But the term, I guess they were saying that they want to continue to use the term black or African-American. I just think just in general, like under the system of white supremacy, for the longest time, they've found ways to constantly strengthen racism by adding more violent or destructive connotations to that term black. But then at the same time, they'll have a white person, and I know we don't talk about entertainment, but the movie Black Widow, they'll have the term black in that context, and then Black Panther, but they'll still use terms like dark, and then they already know they program people's minds to juxtapose dark wickedness being tainted, and a lot of it is racism. And I'm glad that that segment was played. The next thing I wanted to mention was the terms that was used when they were talking about the COVID-19 and the unvaccinated. That's the term that's being used. I think that's absolving a lot of whites. Now, there are black people, of course, non-white people that are unvaccinated, if we're going to use that term. I just get the sense, I mean, I don't have no evidence, but just by the way that the news reports are going, I think it's a lot of white resentment or for lack of a better word, rejection of the shot or getting the vaccine, because I'm also seeing the reports of how hostile the air flights. If you've seen the news reports, I've seen mainly white people punching people in the face, being carried off. I've seen people with a pale complexion, you know, being showing animosity, like wanting to physically attack people, being violent. But they don't never say, well, hey, the majority of the unvaccinated, it seems to be breaking down like how they was doing. If anybody remember how they were saying black and brown, people of color, you know, it seems to be some issues with the cases in this area. But if you notice, they said the word rural or underserved or something like that. Like, who are they talking about? Like when they say rural in my area, that's what they seem to connect it to when they make local news reports. The country, the areas where there's a lot of vegetation and space, grass, they seem to show white people in these small towns where I'm at. And I have wanted to mention one more thing. I was for some reason thinking about that episode or that broadcast. I think it's called White People Can Ruin Your Life in 5 Minutes. I might have butchered it, but I was thinking about that when it came to alcohol and how you could, you never know how the environment could be if you happen to be anywhere. Like, white supremacy is strong. And it just started just by, I hadn't listened to the broadcast in a while, but something, I guess, about how a white woman looked at someone, or how the victims were beginning to notice some tension, I guess, and how it just went from that point to just violence and fighting in just no time. So that's one thing I wanted to mention, that episode right there. Was that the name of that broadcast, Gus? And that's all I had. Thank you.
I believe so. That's 2012, summer of 2012. I think June, close to so-called Father's Day, unless my memory is off. But generally, the neck of the woods, June 2012. But yep, white people can ruin your life in 5 minutes. Remember, it was white woman throwing her hair. I made a sound clip out of it. Throwing her hair on the other victims, instigated everything. And the server was, you know, unwilling to help, or I don't remember if they asked to move, but the server didn't seem willing to assist in the matter, and escalated, ended up having white people who didn't even know each other, who seemed to pitch in and participate in bludgeoning, terrorizing non-white people. And then I think the police came, and the only person charged was the non-white person, the black male. So yeah, definitely something to think about. If you're in an environment where alcohol is going to be served, like, whew, lots of potential hazards. Man, and having a code, that was one. Even the victims who went through all of that, man, talk about the importance of having a code. That was one of the first things they said, like, whew, once it looks like things are headed in that direction, check please, let's ride. Like, maybe we don't need to be here anyway. Like, should we have to sit down and try to have a meal, and we got white people behind us slinging their hair on us left and right, and the server doesn't seem like she's willing to, maybe, I said that yesterday too, like, that going out to eat stuff, like, try to minimize that as much as possible for a variety of reasons, including you don't want to get into random brawls with other patrons. Now, that about the black, I think we talked about that before, black, Negro, African-American, African descendant of slavery, it really doesn't matter if it all means nigger at the end of the day, which it does. Now, the unvaccinated, talking about words, that is interesting. I will have to pay attention to that. I know in this segment, because they were talking about Arkansas, and they've been saying, you know, it's a lot of white people in these regions who, you know, as you said, are defiant, resistant to getting vaccinated as well. But I'm going to have to pay attention to that, because they have been saying that they suspect there could be some sort of what they call vaccine divide. And I've been saying the whole time it's been disproportionately white people being vaccinated. Non-white people haven't had the same access. So that's interesting. If I heard it correctly, you're saying you think just with the use of this term, the unvaccinated, and we heard President Biden in the audio segments where he was talking about, man, we're having it's the unvaccinated. That's what we're having, the pandemic, the unvaccinated. If I heard you correctly, called in Florida, where this term making it seem like it's shifting blame and accountability to individuals if they have not been vaccinated, and seeming like this could end up being blame to non-white people for being irresponsible, shiftless, jeopardizing public health by not going ahead and getting your jab. Kind of restating what you said with this term unvaccinated?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm glad you put it that way, because just really quick, I have seen some of the reports in the past few days, and it does look like they're trying to display black people, like one sitting in a wheelchair being wheeled out of the hospital. Oh, such and such in this area, she was thinking about not getting the vaccine. And then the reporter, the journalist, was asking, well, are you going to plan now to get the vaccine? And she's like, well, I don't know. Maybe. It just stories like that. And then they showed someone that I guess was helping to report about the NBA finals, blackmail. He said that he's in quarantine. So that's what I'm beginning to notice. Like, they're trying to shift it from the white people having a resistance to it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm going to have to pay attention just to how they're using that word, and just what does it sound like when they start talking about the unvaccinated, how that plays out over the summer, especially going into the fall. It's basically almost August. Once we hit like September, because in states like California and other places where they have those mandates, where once some of these vaccines get FDA approval, that mandatory city employee or you work at this hospital or whatever it is, got to be vaccinated. I read a report yesterday that said the people that are unvaccinated, we're getting rid of them. That was the headline of the report. So I will definitely be paying more attention to that to see if that's, you know, kind of the feeling that it's getting. It's these irresponsible, but I don't know if I want to get vaccinated when it's been white defiance from day one. It's just that we had listeners who reported all over in North Carolina. These weren't even white adults. These were white children. Got on a plane. What do you mean wear a mask? I'm not wearing a mask for anything. I just graduated high school. I'm 17 years old. Not even free white and 21. This is free white and 17. Tell me to put a mask on. Done with the Rona. We get on a plane. We are flying. They had to shut down a whole flight in North Carolina. They said it was like 20, 30 children. White children got on a plane. Total defiance. Cut a fool. I'm not putting a mask on. That's not the picture, the image that they, I think, are projecting when they get to talking about the unvaccinated. Can't be turning around and then it's me and the rest of these dark folks. The unvaccinated keeping us in peril. No, it's those white urchins on the plane in North Carolina. That's who's got us in peril. Let's see. Much obliged caller in Florida. Did we miss any folks that had a hand up that we missed totally? Didn't miss anybody. Double checking. We have 10 minutes or so left in the broadcast. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I could even here, because I'm in Seattle, where they said Seattle is one of the first major cities where 70% of the population is vaccinated. I've seen so many individuals who are classified as white, where they have all kinds of paraphernalia bragging about their vaccination status, like t-shirts, vaccinated. I saw one t-shirt, it said caffeinated, vaccinated. Like lots of them. They got all kinds of wardrobe and everything else to brag about, and I guess also encourage other people to follow suit and all the rest of it. So it would not surprise me if that's kind of the image of the people who are responsible, healthy citizens in the U.S., that sort of image, this type of city, and then the opposite, because it consistently goes to the Bible Belt and the South when they get to talking about places where this is a problem. They were talking in Arkansas and places South Florida, those type of regions. Just be mindful. I guess we'll add that to our words, a list of words that we are quote-unquote policing, just being mindful about in their usage for the rest of the summer, maybe rest of the year, unvaccinated. Any other thoughts, folks? Want to make sure they get in the vaccine policy in particular. As I said, if we have attempted parents, and or if you think you're going to be going to like on campus, in person school, college, grad school type thing this coming fall, that will be something to consider. Rob in California, we were talking about that yesterday on Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Like, you might have to make that choice. If I want to go to school, might have to be vaccinated. Like, it'll be something to ponder for a number of folks. I know they don't have that policy everywhere, but a number of regions, and it could grow higher, especially if this continues with what they're saying, the Delta variant, and oops, we had, you know, masks off, now we got to go mask back on, and all the rest of it could end up making for a very continuing confusing conclusion to the year. Other thoughts folks wanted to make sure they got in?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Golden from Ohio. Our governor, probably about a week ago, signed, added language to a bill that, let me get my notes here, that it won't take effect for 90 days, but it was making it not mandatory for public schools or universities to require students to be vaccinated. So that just falls in line with, you know, just racists taking both sides. So we've got this big push, like earlier in the spring before school was out, they were on the campuses and really pushing for students to get vaccinated before they went home. And now he signs a bill or some language added into another obscure bill that has nothing to do with, you know, COVID vaccine. But so he's mandating that anyone will not be required to take, oh, and this is the extra part, a vaccine that has full approval from the FDA. So knowing that they're trying to fast track and get approval, this pretty much might be moot by the time the vaccine does get approved by FDA, you know. So that's just kind of more, I don't know, just political back and forth. And with respect to vaccine, there's still like a real big push. They're concentrating on Black people to get it. So the report where the woman was saying that people just don't understand, you know, I've asked quite a few questions, you know, like, well, what do the people, you know, these doctors say about, you know, what the governor's just signed? If, you know, they want us to vaccinate, why did the governor just sign something saying that it's not mandatory? And not only that, you can't suffer repercussions. You can't isolate the people who aren't vaccinated. You can't disallow them from participating in sports. He was very specific with it. But as I said, come to find out, it just may be moot if the vaccine does get approved and, you know, one or more. So that was something. Then also with the push to vaccinate, there's been all these things going on. There's somebody here locally, I guess it's, her name is Nurse Jenny. She keeps coming on the radio and she's doing all these pop-up things. So they're at restaurants giving out fish plates and, you know, just really ridiculous stuff. And I don't know if this is national or if it's something that they've come up with here, to the tune of back that thing up. They've got vax that thing up. So, I mean, just really just craziness to really appeal to Black people, as I said, and it just gets worse and worse. So now there's some jingle and, you know, of course the vaccinated people are going around singing it and kind of taunting the non-vaccinated Black people. So it's just crazy. And that's all I got. Thanks.
Well, I could have gone my whole summer without hearing that, but it is online. You can check it out, download it. I'm reading this from The Verge. The new version of Juvenile's Back That Thing Up is a full-on parody, practically. Juvenile makes it rain vaccine cards instead of cash money. Eggplant emoji are out in full force, and it sure sounds like sure random dude named Scott is about to look out. I guess they have some sort of, this is supposed to show all the wonderful things that can happen once you get vaccinated. You can get back out and party and have fun and touch people and all the rest of it. Breathe all over everybody. Like, now this reminds me, the caller in Florida, when he said the way the word unvaccinated was going to be used, like if this is the propaganda that's going to be associated with our campaign to get the stragglers, so-called, like is let's get juvenile and do vax that thing. Like, what? What are they going to do for the white stragglers? I'm just like, what do they do for the legions of white people who have been staunch and in denial from day one? Like, I don't know. What's their catch to appeal to them? They did the lottery. Like, what are they going to do? Go back, I don't know, get Nirvana and remix one of their jingles from the 90s? Like, we'll ponder the word unvaccinated. Maybe we'll play Vax That Thing Up for next week. I thought they had all this about Me Too and objectivity and all the rest. Like, why do we want to resurrect that song? And yes, this will get the black people to take it seriously, get out there and get that jab. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Doesn't get any better than tacky.
Well, here in Illinois they have a vaccine lottery where you can out of a $10 million prize money you can actually win when I think $7 million in cash. And since the Pfizer vaccine is approved for emergency use in children, children can actually win $3 million in scholarship money. That's another incentive they've been, promoting out here in Illinois and Chicago.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, the Rona, I don't even know what to call it. The Rona wackiness continues. I found one extra report just to drift back to Ohio briefly. They had those lotteries here as well where you could get lots of money for getting the vaccine. I think someone made up $1 million. That was on the front page of the paper, the Seattle Times today. A guy, they said in South Seattle in King County, he won Martin Luther King's King County. Won $1 million for getting vaccinated and the lottery or whatever. So the New York Post, they also vaxxed that thing up. They got on it. They said, juvenile, the lyrics were written to encourage Americans to get vaccinated. Girl, you look good once you vax that thing up. You're a handsome young brother, once you vax that thing up. Dating in real life, you need to vax that thing up. I'll leave it at that. Y'all can go online to listen or get the rest of the lyrics. Vax that thing up. Any other comments, questions folks need to get in? I don't know. I think if we came this far, and I've heard Dr. Fauci and everyone else, Joe Biden, all these other folks, if I'm not vaccinated by now, I don't know if a remix from Juvenile is going to be the tipping point. I could be in error. And again, I'm not a doctor. Everybody satisfied? Got in everything they needed to share?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Just really quick, I wanted to mention on the black soccer players and the way that, well, from the report that I've seen, I guess they were saying one of the Prince, I think it was Prince William, I think I got it correct. He was speaking out, or he had a quote to say about it, talking about the racist abuse. Well, you know, they shouldn't go through this or something like that. But then it was people calling out the hypocrisy about the Harry and Meghan Markle situation a few months ago. So I thought that was interesting as well. Of course, white supremacists and the hypocrisy deception. I just wanted to mention that. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
For sure. If this had been any other week, we would have included a segment about the racism against the soccer players, because I thought that was really important. And that was like the biggest news in Europe, many parts of the world, in fact, because lots of here, they had at lots of the bars here in Seattle that are open now. That's what they were watching all through the week leading up to that incident where they fussed at and practiced racism against the European soccer players. That would have been included. But for two reasons, there were so many things that happened. And Monday seems like, you know, old news by now. And since we have the Global Sunday Talk tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific, we can do that tomorrow. And we should have people from England here so we can hear directly about how their fellow countrymen went from galvanizing and, you know, we're all in this together and coming out of the Rona and it's great. Oh, my God, these niggas ruined it all. Let's kick them out of the So, yes, we will definitely bring that up tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on racism, that among many of the other international reports. With that, we'll call it a broadcast. I see we had some of our folks listening in from the Arizona area. Surprised they're not watching the game. Go Suns, go Suns. Again, we'll be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on racism. Amy Schmidt, white woman, should be coming to the cows shortly. That said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Save that brain computer. We will have lots of important decisions to make to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, if you're going out and about, they're threatening to shoot pregnant black females in the face. Be alert. Might not just be one armed white man, white woman, whatever. Could be a whole entourage. If you go out, if you're not prepared to kill and or die immediately, exit. Very dangerous times. Lots of new gun owners who are stressed and or racist or whatever else. With all of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate.
Disconnected me at the last moment. Help us demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Cow signing out, no name calling, no gossiping, talked about that, no killing other black people, victims of racism. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.